Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband and ancient tales.
Alright, alright, alright. Good morning, everyone. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studios, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. I am your overnight dude here every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Hi. After 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive right here on WGN, as it is every weekday morning. How's it going? It's Tuesday, everybody. Yeah, man, two for Tuesday. And you know what that means. You pick, the songs. It's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. We'll play them later. Every morning, you guys pick, the bumps that will be played from, coming back from news and commercials as we rejoin the show. And there's a theme every day, and today is Two for Tuesday. So get your requests in now at 312-981-7200. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, Dan Feinberg is going to join us with a special visit. Normally, he joins us every other Thursday, but he's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him on Twitter and on Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we want to get his thoughts on the Emmys. And we know he has a lot of thoughts on that. And we wouldn't be able to wrap up our Emmy coverage without getting our thoughts from our TV critic, Dan Feinberg. So Dan's going to join us in just a couple of minutes. After the 2 o'clock news, we're going to go live to Austin, Texas, to the Fantastic Fest, where associate editor of Daily Grindhouse, Mike Vanderbilt, is going to join us. He'll tell us a little bit about what's happening down there at Fantastic Fest, but we're really going to remember Sid Haig, who was an iconic horror actor, cult figure. He was 80 years old. He passed away a couple of days ago. He's been in hundreds of movies and TV shows. Most people remember him from the Rob Zombie horror films of the past 10 years or so, or 15 years or so, and other, you know, other movies as well. He's worked with Tarantino. He's worked with other directors. He was a legendary guy and a really nice guy, because he had visited us at Flashback Horror Convention at least 4 or 5 times, and he couldn't have been cooler. He couldn't have been nicer, and he couldn't have loved his fans any more than he did. An iconic guy, a guy that you would never forget once you saw his face. I can tell you that much. So Mike's going to talk to us from Austin in the Fantastic Fest, and we'll remember Sid Haig. Also, today marks the anniversary of the first Supreme Court that was established. So on this day in history, a first Supreme Court was established. So we'll talk a little bit about that in history. And then we're going to talk entertainment in terms of courtroom dramas for movies and TV shows about lawyers and courtroom shows. Also, today would have been Phil Hartman's 71st birthday. He was my favorite cast member ever on Saturday Night Live. I think he was the best cast member that Saturday Night, in the history of Saturday Night Live. He was incredibly talented, really, really funny. And how he ended up dying is just an absolute tragedy. It was a murder-suicide that his wife committed. And I'll vividly remember, I'll never forget where I was when I first heard the news that Phil Hartman was killed. So we're going to go back and talk about Phil Hartman, remember his great stuff on SNL and other shows like news radio and in movies. He was a brilliantly funny guy, and we're going to talk about his life and remember him on what would have been his 71st birthday. And we'll play some audio from some of his funniest stuff, too. So that's all coming up on the show. 312-981-7200 for talk and text, two for Tuesday requests. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Let me say hello to my great producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you, buddy?
I'm really good, Nick. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm excited to get Dan's thoughts on the Emmys.
Yeah, I know.
There's going to be some good stuff in there.
Yeah, he's been working hard, round the clock.
Round the clock. It's this week is the beginning of all the fall previews, the premieres, actually. Busy time for Dan Feinberg, and I'm glad he's taking the time to talk to us about to wrap up the Emmy coverage. So that's coming up, and a lot more. Phil Hartman, you love Phil Hartman, right?
Huge fan of Phil Hartman, especially him as Troy McClure.
Yeah.
Always made me laugh.
Yep.
So my favorite character on The Simpsons.
Yep. And Sid Haig, obviously. We found out about the news right before we got out of here yesterday morning. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really confirmed yet. We weren't sure about it yet, but I was surprised to see that he had passed away. So Sid Haig, legendary guy. In the newsroom, we've got Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, pal?
Very well. Doing very well.
Did you enjoy the Bears?
I have not seen it yet, so don't tell me what happened.
Okay. So you're just going to leave that out of your sports reports?
Well, I've been reading it, but I'm just not listening to myself, what I'm saying.
That's good. That's good. Well, you DVR the game, so you're going to watch it because you're a real football fan.
Yes, sir.
All right. Very
well,
cool.
Well, I'm a Bears fan.
You're
I don't really watch
fan.
Much of the other teams. But
okay. Well, they won big.
They did.
So,
yeah, they did.
There you go. Enjoy that game in the morning.
The W. You know. Thank you, sir.
So we are going to be discussing the Emmys and the Emmys and the Emmy coverage and the broadcast and the winners and the losers, all that stuff with Dan Feinberg in just a couple of minutes. But I was watching Jimmy Kimmel last night before I came down here to work. And during his monologue, he played a clip of a red carpet interview at the Emmys. And there are tons of reporters and they're lined up all over. Well, they actually had a purple carpet this year at the Emmys. And Sam Rubin and his, and I can't remember who his co-host's name is, but Sam Rubin's a legendary guy, been an entertainment reporter for a long time. And most infamously, was doing an interview with Samuel L. Jackson and mistaken him for Larry Fishburne.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Sam Rubin was on the purple carpet and he was interviewing Terrence Howard from Empire. This is before the Emmys. Now, he asks him a pretty straightforward question about whether or not he's going to stay with Empire or leave Empire. There have been rumors about him maybe leaving the show. All we can do is actually just play this. This is for real. This is not altered. Sam Rubin, entertainment reporter for KTLA TV, on the purple carpet, asks Terrence Howard a simple question, and here's Terrence Howard.
Lucius is in the house. Terrence Howard here. You made huge headlines when you said, after you complete these 15 episodes of Empire, you got to walk away for a while or forever?
For good. I mean, everyone keeps trying to tell me, don't say it's forever. But I've spent 37 years pretending to be people so that people can pretend to watch and enjoy what I'm doing when I've made some discoveries in my own personal life with the science that, you know, Pythagoras was searching for. I was able to open up the flower of life properly and find the real wave conjugations that we've been looking for 10,000 years. Why would I continue, you know, walking on water for tips when I've got an entire generation to teach a whole new world?
That's a big remark. Yeah. What do you intend to do?
Well, let me put it this way. All energy in the universe is expressed in motion. All motion is expressed in waves. All waves are curved. So where does the straight lines come from to make the platonic solids? There are no straight lines. So when I took the flower of life and opened it properly, I found whole new wave conjugations that expose the in-between spaces. It's the thing that holds us all together.
Sam Rubin was really funny because the girl who was next to him, who was also conducting the interviews, she just looked like, what is happening right now? Am I on acid? What the hell is going on? And he was dressed very weirdly, had like a ascot with a vest in it. He's always been kind of a strange guy, Terrence Howard, always. So there you go, everybody. There's a typical Hollywood actor on Emmys night.
You know, I don't think I've heard the name Pythagoras since I was a sophomore in high school. Open the flower of life?
I don't know, man.
There are no straight lines.
That's not fake. That was Terrence Howard leaving acting. So, all right. So I thought we could kick off our Emmy coverage with that interview, actual interview of Terrence Howard on the red carpet. Okay. Let us break. Let's break, and we'll come back to Earth. We have to come back to Earth at this point. Dan Feinberg is going to join us, and we'll wrap up all the Emmy coverage coming up right here on WGN.
TV party tonight. We're gonna have a TV party tonight. All right. We're gonna have a TV party. All right.
Tonight. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and here till 5 a.m. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Mike Vanderbilt is going to join us. He is an assistant editor at Daily Grindhouse. He contributes to AV Club. He is also going to be live from Fantastic Fest in Austin. We're going to talk about that, but we're mostly going to remember Sid Haig, who passed away. It was announced literally at the end of my show yesterday, right, Tom? Right at the end of our show?
Yeah, it was actually Mike that broke the news to me, at the very least. He posted on Facebook about it, and I immediately reached out to him. I was like, is this for real? He says, yeah, it's for real.
So we'll talk about Sid Haig. Sid Haig was a cult a film actor, been in hundreds of movies for many, many, many years. I think most recently, obviously, he's most known for the Rob Zombie films that he did, including Devil's Rejects, House of a Thousand Corpses, and Three from Hell. And he was at our flashback horror convention at four or five. He visited at least four or five times and could not be a nicer guy and a very cool dude. So he was a horror icon. So we're going to remember Sid Haig a little bit later on. Right now, though, you heard the TV theme. That means that Dan Feinberg is going to join us. But you know what? It's not the second Thursday. It's a Tuesday. What? The Emmys were Sunday night. And so we definitely wanted to get Dan's thoughts on that. Dan is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Also, the premiere week begins like crazy. All the brand new fall shows kick off. So we wanted to get some thoughts on that, too. But let's get Dan in here. Hi, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All right. You're just a crazy, crazy beginning to the week.
It really, really is. You know that feeling that you have kind of the day after your birthday, where you're either really, really happy because it's the longest period of time before your next birthday, or you're really, really sad because it's the longest period of time before your next birthday?
Uh-huh.
That is what the day after Emmys feels like.
Okay. All right. I agree. So which one do you feel? Do you feel happy or do you feel sad?
I feel mostly relief, I think. I think that I am perfectly happy to downshift a little bit in that particular respect and let all of the lunatics on my Twitter feed who are part of movie Twitter start revving up for Oscar season, because mm-hmm. that one lasts for 5 months.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of more invested in that, because obviously I review movies here at the station. And that's exhausting. You're absolutely. I mean, I always take the morning after the Oscars off from work. So that Monday morning, I stay home.
Well, I could not do that, because as usual, the Emmys lead directly into premiere week, so there is no such thing as downtime.
All right. Well, I appreciate you taking time to hang with us. All right. Well, let's. Let's talk about the show, Dan. I did not read your full review, but I know you were not a fan of the broadcast.
It depends on how you look at things. Either you review the things that the producers of the show had actual control over, and if you review those things, it was probably the worst Emmy telecast I've ever seen, and maybe one of the worst award show telecasts I've ever seen. Mm. But if you have to take into account that, yes, they have control over things, but they also don't have control over much of it, and there are always going to be the things that are out of their control, and so how were those things? Well, those things were actually kind of wonderful. There were a lot of really great moments that the producers had no control over, and so I think they got a little bit lucky that there are good things to talk about today, as opposed to just what an absolute series of blunders the telecast was from a producing standpoint.
Yeah. Chief of which was the whole Thomas Lennon thing. I just I just don't get it. And I know they've tried this before. They've had somebody backstage before at these award ceremonies trying to, like, take you through to the commercial. But, man, I don't know who wrote the material. I don't know whose idea it was and how they handled it, but it was terrible.
It was not good. I have to admit I laughed a couple times, and I think probably the hit-to-miss ratio was somewhere in the neighborhood of, say, the three hits and about 50 misses, which is not a very good percentage, regardless of what sport you choose to align it with. But I laughed a couple times. I would never do that again. It was those one or two laughs. I chuckled at the Felicity Huffman joke. I don't care if that makes me a bad person.
Oh, no,
and
I think I
laughed at it.
I gotta say I did. I laughed at that. I did. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So I laughed at that, and I laughed at least one of the jokes about Chernobyl. There were a couple decent jokes about Chernobyl. So those were not worth the gimmick. There were enough things which were either excruciatingly unfunny or just distracting, which were then also conflated with the fact that he was constantly talking over people coming up to the stage, and the people coming up to the stage were doing so over often quite random music. Like, who was it who made the determination that Feeling Good was what they were going to play for the lead-in to Chernobyl? So it was all a mess. Like, I think if you were to look at the boxes that the producers of the shows checked, they checked the wrong box on almost everything.
Yeah. Also, and to this effect, it was the lowest rated Emmys in years. It dropped 33% from last year, and it was one of the. And Sunday Night Football beat it.
And I think that it comes down to the show was always going to drop, and the show was always going to drop for a variety of reasons. Ratings are always lower for the Emmys on Fox. That is simply the reality for whatever reason, and I think that basically there was the strange blip that for some reason the Oscars went up this past year, and whether that was because of all the conversation about hostlessness or realistically whether it was because of Black Panther or whatever you want, they went up. But that was the anomaly. That wasn't the rule. So they were always going to go down. They didn't need to go down as much as they did. But on the other hand, they didn't go down because it was a horrible show. That just meant that fewer people had to watch a horrible show. So that's almost a relief.
All right, let's talk about a few more of the missteps. How about the fact that they didn't have a picture of Andre Previn during the In Memoriam, and it was Leonard Slatkin that was up on the screen?
The In Memoriam was, you know, that's always a place where you almost can't do it right, because anything you do wrong ends up being so magnified because of the nature of the thing.
Yeah.
So no one is ever going to be like, "Ooh, you nailed that one. Way to memorialize." No one's going to do that.
Right.
So, you know, obviously that was a blunder, and I didn't notice it until people started reporting it, but, you know, you don't want to do that. That was stupid. I don't understand how, with all the people who passed in the past, you know, year, like Carol Channing ended up with the last image. I just don't get that, but then you're getting into the how much do we value dead people conversation, and that's not a good conversation to be having. It wasn't especially good. I didn't mind Halsey's performance once I figured out it was Halsey and not Pink.
I thought she was great. I thought she was, it was a beautiful performance, and it was really funny because I watched Kimmel last night before I came down here to work, and he had Leonard Slatkin on. He interviewed him via Skype, and it was hilarious because he's in Ireland right now, and people were, you know, like 4 o'clock in the morning. He said he got up to check the baseball scores because he's a baseball fanatic, and he found out that he was dead. He had no idea, and he said that he knew Andre Previn and said that he deserved better, but he also said that Andre Previn is not spinning in his grave. I'm sure he's laughing. So, but it was really funny. Jimmy Kimmel, you know, did a nice, really funny interview with the guy.
Well, they got some positive out of it, and, you know, it gives people a chance to talk about Andre Previn today and to actually post real pictures of Andre Previn. There's that. I don't know. Yeah, that was not good. Honestly, I think we got spoiled because we all felt like the Oscars proved that you don't need a host, and then to me, last night's Emmy telecast proved that you definitely
I agree.
Can use a host.
I agree. I also didn't understand, sometimes they announced the nominees before the presenters came out, sometimes they didn't. I mean, what was that?
It was bad, and it was not a good choice. The Oscars, I believe, did something comparable this past year as well, and it didn't work then. So it means that you have all the names read, and then you have the two people coming out, and they're doing little bits of banter for no reason, and in no cases was the banter funny. So it was just dead time as the people waited to have their names announced. It was yet another stupid decision. Yeah. And then, you know, you had the people coming up to the stage to accept their awards, and they were doing it in front of gigantic backdrops of themselves, usually with the least flattering pictures imaginable. Right. That was strange.
Yeah. And it was just absolutely weird. And the picture of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, by the way, she's bleeding from her nose, and you got to see that. You got to see that nice and large right behind her.
And every one of them, the pictures were somewhat ridiculous, which meant that all of the pictures that were in the media today were all pictures of that. So you're pretty much making not just the moment itself awkward and somewhat visually discordant, but you're basically perpetuating that for as long as anyone remembers the 71st Emmy. Yeah. So, yay, way to cement the image in people's minds forever, I guess.
All right. Well, look, we're talking about the bad stuff, but we want to get to some of the winners and some of the surprises of the night. And I thought there were a lot of surprises in terms of who won those awards in a good way.
I was blown away by a lot of it.
Yeah, I'm sure you were, because every time Fleabag won, I was just like, Dan's losing his mind right now. All right,
I was very happy.
I bet. Okay, hang on a second. Okay,
sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. He joins us every couple of Thursdays. He'll be with us a week from Thursday for his regular TV visit. But since we had the Emmys the other night, we wanted to obviously get his thoughts on it. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. We'll return after the news with more Emmy talk right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. We are back here, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on a Tuesday morning. And we're going to be talking with Mike Vanderbilt and remembering Sid Haig, who passed away a couple of days ago. He was a horror actor, a cult figure, an icon, and the assistant editor of Daily Grindhouse, who is Mike Vanderbilt, who's also going to be broadcasting live from the Fantastic Fest in Austin. So we'll get a little update on that, too. But we're going to remember Sid Haig. And also, today in history is the first Supreme Court was established. So in honor of that, we're going to talk about courtroom dramas in both TV and movies. And do you like those things? I love them when they're good. All right. So the Emmys were a couple of nights ago, Sunday night. And we wanted to get a report from our buddy Dan Feinberg, who reports on TV with us. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him at The Fine Print on Twitter and Facebook, and that's FIEN. And we want to get more of his thoughts on the Emmys. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
Okay, so I do want to talk about a couple of things that I thought were funny on the show before we get into like the winners. I thought Maya Rudolph and Ike Barinholtz were hilarious. I don't know why it just made me laugh. And the Ted Danson, they get the Ted Danson pronunciation correct. I don't know why, but that killed me. So I thought that was very funny. I thought they were good.
Whew, I thought that bit had moments. It was one of those fun things that started off funny, then ceased to be funny, and then kind of became funny again by the end. But like so many of the bits of banter or patter, it went on too long. On the other hand, it was blissfully swift compared to whatever it was that Ken Jeong did with TikTok.
Oh, my God.
That was horrible.
I don't know. That was really, wow, yeah, that was really bad. I'm just thinking back to it now, and it was really, really, really terrible. And man, how many plugs were they doing for The Masked Singer? I mean, I knew because it was on Fox, we were going to see some Fox shows plugged. But my God, I mean, to have the Masked Singers come out on stage at one point, I was like, what are we, this is the Emmys.
It was pathetic, and the thing I don't get is why they didn't just have the four or five, if you include Nick Cannon, Masked Singer people just host the show. You know, if all you wanted to do was do it as an extended commercial for Masked Singer, let him host the show.
Well, Jenny McCarthy was awful on the red carpet beforehand, and got to see, they paraded out all of the Masked Singers during that, and I mean, it was just, I was like, you know what, and I like the Masked Singer, but I was starting to dislike it while I was watching the show, so.
Oh, I know, I came to the conclusion that I will not be watching this season during last night's telecast, so yeah. I hope that Fox is pleased. I was absolutely going to tune in for a couple episodes. Now I really don't have any desire.
All right. So, was there anything else that you thought was entertaining or good besides the amount of shocking and really cool winners from last night or from Sunday night?
No, and that was what I enjoyed, and I enjoyed so much of that, and I enjoyed so much of the unspooling sense of unpredictability, which almost never happens on a show like this. And yet, watching the Emmys, it really was the case almost the entire night. You know, there were the obvious bits, like, okay, you knew Saturday Night Live was going to win and whatever. You knew Last Week Tonight with John Oliver was going to win, and that was good. You knew RuPaul's Drag Race was going to win. You know, so there was the kind of kernel of boredom in the middle of the show. But in the actual major categories, left and right,
yeah,
I was being astounded by almost every award.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And, yeah, so, I mean, it wasn't a surprise that Game of Thrones won. I think everybody knew that. And, you know, but I was thinking because of the way things were going, Sunday night, that there was a possibility that maybe it wouldn't win, you know, and they might give it to something like Pose, which would be, you know, incredible, right?
I just didn't think there was any chance that was going to happen. And I never for a second thought there was going to be an upset for drama series. But what I felt and what I felt every step of the way was, okay, if they have to give this to Game of Thrones, and they did and whatever, at least it wasn't going to be a situation where it won absolutely everything. And I think that there was a world in which it could have won a ridiculous number. It could have somehow won for writing. It could have won for directing. Several of the other actors, in addition to Peter Dinklage, could have won. It really could have been a colossal coronation-type sweep for a show that didn't in any way, shape, or form either need, because it had won plenty of Emmys already previously, or deserve, because the last season was a bit of a mess, that sort of coronation. Instead, it wasn't. Instead, like, oh my God, when Succession won for script,
yeah,
I went nuts.
Yeah.
I thought in a million years would I have guessed that that was a possibility.
Yeah.
So, you know, God bless.
Yeah, okay. All right. I remember the last time we spoke, you said that I would hear you yawn all the way from L.A. if Jason Bateman won Best Actor, but he won Best Director. Did you yawn?
At that point, that was just a confirmation of how crazy everything was in the entire in the entire show. Because when he won Director, they were on a streak of like five or six great awards, and I was like, "Wow, they're getting everything right! Man, nailed it!" What? And then, of course, the moment has become a meme already, because Jason Bateman in no way expected to win. And so there's the great shot of everyone around him exploding in happiness and him just being, huh, okay, I'm apparently an Emmy-winning director now. Well, okay, sure, why not?
All right, let's talk about Fleabag. My God, I mean, what a night. I never expected that to happen. And what do you make of that?
Well, you know, the thing I make of it, and this is not something that one normally comes away saying out of the Emmys, is the best show won those categories, period, full stop. And, you know, I know a lot of listeners, and I know a lot of people on Twitter, and I know a lot of people hither and yon have not watched Fleabag. And so let me say again, and I know I've said it a couple times with you.
Yeah.
It was the best show on TV this year. It just was. There's a chance that Succession could sneak in, you know, and jump ahead of it, maybe, whatever. But it was just a wonderful, miraculous season of TV. And, you know, when we last talked, I think I said I just needed her to win one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and so when she won for writing, it was like, okay, great, that'll do, Pig.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah. I can live with this. Whatever crazy stuff happens now, I can live with it. And then she kept winning, and for heaven's sakes, it won for direction. And in several of the categories, I could go, okay, I would have loved to see dot, dot, dot win. So when we last talked, I would have loved to see Natasha Lyonne win something.
Right.
And, you know, Bill Hader absolutely, totally could have won for direction, and I would have been very happy.
Yeah.
But Harry Bradbeer's direction of the season 2 premiere is astonishingly good and astonishingly subtle. He doesn't have a kung fu fighting little girl to cut away to make everyone go, oh my goodness. No, it's an entire episode set at a restaurant, and it is as well constructed, both writing and directing, as any episode of TV you could ever watch. Mm-hmm. So I was just so happy.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you, but I wanted Hader to win. Because Ronnie Lilly was my favorite episode of television last season. It was absolutely,
yeah, and it was,
yeah,
and it was a great episode. But, and he won for acting. And again, could I have come up with another alternative there who I might have liked to see as much? Maybe, but he got that. He deserved it. Huzzah!
Yeah.
You know, they did not feel the need to spread the wealth to absolutely everything, and you know, maybe they could have, but. No, I was very happy because Fleabag was a wonderful 6 episodes of TV this year.
Yeah.
And deserved it.
Yeah, it's a great show. It is a great show. I do want to mention that I was really, for some reason, like I knew that would never happen, but I was still rooting for Steven Root to win supporting actor, and I knew there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell that he would, but that's his first nomination, which to me is unbelievable that he's been doing movies and TV for such a long time, he's never been honored with a nomination. I couldn't believe that.
And if he had won, it would have been wonderfully exciting. Tony Shalhoub is just,
yeah,
beloved, and
yeah,
there's, you know, what can you say other than Emmy voters like Tony Shalhoub?
Yeah, exactly. And so do Tony voters. So,
sure.
Okay, Dan, hang on, all right?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. We're wrapping up the Emmy Awards. We wanted to get Dan's opinion on it since he's our TV guy. He joins us every other Thursday, and he'll be with us a week from Thursday for his regular visit, but he joins us this morning to wrap up the Emmys, and we'll do that when we get back right here on 720 WGN. Wow, together. Welcome back, everybody. It is a Tuesday morning. 2 for Tuesday. Get your requested now. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're talking with Dan Feinberg. He is the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we're wrapping up the Emmys. So let's get Dan back in here. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
See, the feedback that I was getting from my listeners yesterday morning after the awards when I was, you know, discussing them was that people... There are a lot of people out there who do not have a lot of the streaming services, who are tired of seeing, you know, pay cable channels or streaming services win all the awards. And they at least two or three people said that they should have like two different Emmy Awards, one for broadcast TV and one for the streaming and the cable. And I understand that because you said a lot of people have not seen Fleabag. So a lot of people watching the show last night were like, what is this? You know, and, you know, even to the point where. You know, some of the others, like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, a lot of people probably haven't seen that, who just watched your broadcast or your basic cable. So what do you think about that? I mean, that was kind of a strong thing that my listeners were talking about last night.
Man, the Bring Back the Cable Ace Awards hot take is just one you don't expect to hear. So the first thing I have to say is, the world does not need more award shows.
Okay.
So That is the first and primary thing I have to say. The second thing is, do I think that maybe there are adjustments that could be made that would give the broadcast networks a little bit more visibility or viability? Yes. Whether it's as simple as the Oscars saying we're going to go to 10 Best Picture nominees, that way we can get in a Dark Knight or a Black Panther. So by that theory, let's go to 10 nominations and maybe we get another additional Speechless in, or The Good Place is nominated every year or something. But you could go 50 deep and not get a broadcast drama in a top 10. So that wouldn't help there. The thing I would say, and I know this is horribly snobby and it does nothing for the ratings, is it's a qualitative award show. And are the networks at a disadvantage? Yeah, they are, and particularly when it comes to drama, having to do 22 episodes of network drama with the restrictions they have on content and language and all of that.
Yeah.
It's an imposition. It just is. I cannot argue with that. But if you've never heard of the shows that won last night, give some of them a look. That's what this should be about.
Yeah.
It should be about I just saw Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She's the most charming person I've seen in my life. I should watch this. I just saw Billy Porter. He is a ray of light from the heavens. Like, good gracious, I have to watch his show now.
Yeah.
Take it as that, not as a confirmation that the things that I already watch are good. If you like them, they're already good. Take it as a, here are shows that I didn't know existed. They look interesting to me now. I'm going to spend my weekend binging Fleabag, which will take you 6 hours.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good point. We have a little bit of a couple of the speeches from Sunday night. I want to start with Michelle Williams, who is so great and so amazing and was so great in Fosse Verdon. And I think she gave one of the best speeches of the night. We have a little bit of it, Tom?
I see this as an acknowledgement of what is possible when a woman is trusted to discern her own needs, feels safe enough to voice them, and respected enough that they'll be heard. When I asked for more dance classes, I heard yes. More voice lessons, yes. A different wig, a pair of fake teeth not made out of rubber, yes. And all of these things, they require effort and they cost more money, but my bosses never presumed to know better than I did about what I needed in order to do my job and honor Gwen Verdon. And so I want to say thank you so much to FX and to Fox 21 Studios for supporting me completely and for paying me equally.
There you go. And then she went on that front. And I thought that was one of the better speeches of the night.
Oh, she's wonderful. And as I'm sure I mentioned when we talked about the TCA Awards, her TCA Awards speech was even better because it went on for longer and no one cared if she swore and other various things. She's really good. She's really smart and she means it.
Yeah. If someone were to tell me like 20 something years ago that the girl from Halloween H2O and Dawson's Creek would want to be one of the most important and amazing actresses of all time, I would just say, shut up. And she turned into just that. It's amazing to have watched this career that she has. She's so, so extraordinarily talented, really.
She's amazing. Her speech was great. And, yeah, I've seen some people try suggesting on Twitter that her speech was political, and if the things that she said in that speech were count as political to you, then I don't know what to say.
Yeah. All right. How about Patricia Arquette? Another, and she was going to win one of those two prizes, Dan. We've already, that was already discussed. She could have won both of them. But here's Patricia Arquette, a little bit of her.
I'm grateful to be working. I'm grateful at 50 to be getting the best parts of my life. In my heart, I'm so sad. I lost my sister, Alexis, and that trans people are still being persecuted. And I'm in mourning every day of my life, Alexis, and I will be the rest of my life for you until we change the world so that trans people are not persecuted. and give them jobs.
Yeah, that was a pretty great moment, too.
It was a great moment, and then once again, if that's political to you, then I don't know what to say about you.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. All right, how about when Jarrell Jerome won? That was a massive and really incredible moment. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
But most importantly, this is for the men that we know as the Exonerated Five. It's for Raymond, Yusuf, Antron, Kevin, and King Corey Wise. Thank you so much. It's an honor. It's a blessing.
Easily one of the main highlights of the show. It was incredible to see them in the crowd, and it was a great moment and a great win.
It was at that point. It was also vaguely nerve-wracking, the possibility that when they see us might have gone home empty-handed, and that was going to be both a problem on a qualitative level, because I don't think Chernobyl was appreciably better than it. If you want to say it was better, I'm fine with that. But, you know, in the same way that a couple of years ago when Fargo Season 2 didn't win any because, God, I don't even remember which thing. I think it was probably some American Crime Story. I don't know where it got shut out entirely. And I'm like, I wish they could have found a way to spread the wealth a little bit more. If they had had the five real men there, and there had been no opportunity in that show for them to have gotten that recognition, it would have been bad. And Jarrell Jerome was so good in that fourth episode of that miniseries. So I'm glad that they were able to make sure that that moment happened. I mean, not make sure. It wasn't like it was a fix or anything. I'm glad that that moment was able to happen.
Yeah, me too. Me too. It was one of the highlights without question. All right, let's talk about Black Mirror. So it's not a TV movie. Bandersnatch Black Mirror wins Outstanding TV Movie, effectively taking it away what should have won, which would have been Deadwood. So what do you think about that? I mean, is this gonna happen every year?
Well, until someone actually steps in and says this is wrong. I mean, if an episode of an anthology drama series has now won the movie category 3 years in a row, it is time for them to acknowledge something is fundamentally wrong with the categorization. Bandersnatch was not a movie. I will also add that I thought Bandersnatch was awful.
Yeah.
and it was a couple hours of fun. The day it came out, it had no narrative long tail. Nobody has talked about Bandersnatch as a piece of actual entertainment other than a piece of technology since 1 week after it came out.
Right.
It was negligible.
Right.
And for heaven's sakes, this was the chance to give David Milch and the people behind Deadwood one more standing ovation.
Absolutely.
And instead, Bandersnatch.
Yep. And they mentioned David Milch's name on stage. Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot. He should be standing up there. So, anyway.
No, and they also did the, God, it's such an honor to be in a category with those people. Yeah, because you don't belong in the category. you should have been competing in a drama series category where no one would have known how to recognize you, because it's not exactly where they belong either, but you belong more there than in the movie category.
That's right. Okay. Well, there it is. I wanted to end on an aggravating note, Dan.
Thanks, Nick. I appreciate that.
Another busy week of premieres, and also this is the week where Big Brother ends. And I know that you don't care, but for the record, I'm rooting for Nicole. That's the person I'm rooting for. So,
and I am rooting for you to be freed from these shackles for another 10 months. That's what I'm rooting for, Nick.
All right, Dan. Thank you, buddy. I appreciate it. And we'll talk to you a week from Thursday.
Sounds good, Nick.
All right, take care. Dan Feinberg, everybody. TV critic from The Hollywood Reporter. It's always great to talk to him. Follow him on Twitter and on Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. All right, we're going to take a break. We got the news. And then after that, Mike Vanderbilt is going to join us live from the Fantastic Fest in Austin. And we're going to remember Sid Haig. That's all coming up right here on WGN. You've been told, so maybe it's time to learn. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, here till 5 a.m. It's 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday.
One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Who requested the Clapton?
It's coming to us from the 773.
773, I quite wanted to hear a little Clapton. That's one of my dad's favorite Clapton songs. So there you go. Mike Vanderbilt was supposed to join us. He is in Austin, Texas, live at the Fantastic Fest, and I guess he's having a fantastic time because we can't get a hold of him. So, I mean, one of the reasons we were going to have him on was to talk about the Fantastic Fest, sure. He is an assistant editor at Daily Grindhouse, which is a really great genre website that covers Grindhouse movies, horror, sci-fi, all kinds of cool stuff. And he's an assistant editor there, and that's it's a really terrific website. You should check it out. But we were going to discuss Sid Haig, because Mike essentially kind of broke the news, at least on Facebook, yesterday morning right around 5 a.m. when we were getting out of here. And Mike's been on the show before. He's kind of a staple in the world of genre movies as a writer. He's also a very weird guy.
That's an understatement.
But he's cool. But anyway, so the point is that we wanted to talk about Sid Haig. Sid Haig, is one of these guys that if you would recognize him, maybe you don't know his name, but he's one of these guys, if you saw him, you'd go, oh, him. Because no one looked like Sid Haig. No one on the planet looked even remotely like Sid Haig. I'm looking at his IMDb page right now. 149 credits.
Remarkable.
149 credits, and they date back to the 60s. His earliest credit is 1960. And then his first, because that was a short film that he did in 1960, his first credit from 1962 was on the TV series The Untouchables with Robert Stack back in the day. And he played Augie the Hood. He played a lot of hoods in his day. He mostly played villains and maniacs. He had that kind of look. But he's worked with a lot of really great directors, including Tarantino. I guess most notable for the Captain Spaulding character that he created along with Rob Zombie in his trilogy of movies, The House of a Thousand Corpses, followed by Devil's Rejects, and just recently, Three from Hell. He played Captain Spaulding in that. He's the crazy clown, and it's that image has become an iconic thing in the world of horror. I like Sid Haig, and I like him in those movies. I hate those movies, and I hate Rob Zombie. I think Rob Zombie is one of the worst filmmakers on the planet. He's never made a movie that didn't suck. But it's always fun to see Sid Haig in anything. I remember watching Night of the Living Dead 3D. With Sid Haig. That was about 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And it was fun. I mean, he does a lot of those kind of movies, you know, the genre movies, the low-budget stuff, the stuff that goes straight to video. That's what he's been doing for the past bunch of years. But he's done some really great theatrical movies, too. And on TV shows. He's been on everything. He was on Gunsmoke, Mission Impossible, Star Trek, Batman, The Rockford Files, Electra Woman and Dinah Girl. He was a regular on that. Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, Get Smart, Fantasy Island, Sledgehammer, The A-Team, The Fall Guy, Dukes of Hazzard, Just the 10 of Us, MacGyver. It goes on. He worked a lot. Sid Haig, a Hollywood character actor who, for more than 50 years, played thugs, villains, and most famously a psychotic clown named Captain Spaulding, died Saturday. He was 80. His wife, Susan L. Oberg, announced his death on the actor's Instagram account on Monday, writing, "He adored his family, his friends, and his fans. This came as a shock to all of us. No other details were given." They did report, though, that he fell. Was that last week or a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
Like he suffered a fall.
It was within the last couple of weeks. People were concerned, but they had reported almost immediately after that he was making a fairly quick recovery.
Right.
So it's anybody's guess. Obviously, his wife has not shared any further details.
Right.
I'm guessing those will come a little bit later.
Yeah.
But my only guess is that it would be complications due to that incident. But
yeah.
Also, 80, you know, is one of those ages where a small thing can...
Like a fall
can be very dangerous to one's health
right.
in so many ways. So But 80's pretty good for a guy with who's lived the life that Sid Haig has.
Yeah.
Not too shabby.
Yeah. Mr. Haig, who lived in Los Angeles, played bit parts in more than 350 television shows, 70 movies, most notably Jackie Brown, the James Bond thriller, Diamonds Are Forever. He had become a cult figure among horror fans who reveled in his portrayal of a murderous clown who terrorized people in the 2003 Rob Zombie film House of a Thousand Corpses. He would go on to play Captain Spaulding in two other films for its director. Rob Zombie, a musician turned filmmaker, wrote on his Instagram account on Monday of Mr. Haig's death, "Hooray for Captain Spaulding, gone but not forgotten." Fans too expressed their grief on Twitter. Mr. Haig was the recipient of numerous awards for his acting in horror movies, and in August he was awarded the Vincent Price Award for Excellence in the Horror Genre. So, when was the first time you encountered Sid Haig? Was it one of the Rob Zombie movies?
Absolutely. It was Halloween 2006.
Mm-hmm.
We went to a friend's house, and his mom was quite lenient with the movies we were allowed to watch. Normally we were watching much lighter fare when it came to the Halloween stuff, but
yeah,
that was the night that I saw Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead remake, mm-hmm. which I still think is a fantastic version of that.
It is. And it's not in the same league
it's
as
the same
George
league,
Romero's,
but
it's great.
It's bracingly different
yes.
from that. And then House of a Thousand Corpses, which scarred me in ways that are unimaginable. I am also not a big Rob Zombie fan, but I do have a special place in my heart specifically for House of a Thousand Corpses because it introduced me to the things that Rob Zombie was inspired by.
Right.
And also to people like Bill Moseley,
yeah.
like people like Sid Haig. And
I mean, you know, I will say this about Rob Zombie. He does end up getting a lot of really cool people in his movies.
That he does.
Like, just for cameos or for just, you know, I mean, he gets iconic people who have been in the genre. That's the only credit that I can give Rob Zombie. He doesn't give them anything good to do because he sucks. But, you know, they are littered with, like, character actors and actresses who have made their names in iconic genre films.
Yeah, at the very least, he worships at the altar that
yes.
these people are.
Yeah, he's not good,
gods.
But like he watched the same kind of stuff. He and I are around the same age, I think.
Probably. Yeah.
And I in he grew up watching the same stuff that I did, and I've seen interviews with him and everything. And I admire the fact that he loves all that stuff and wants to emulate it, but he's terrible. He makes terrible movies.
Yeah, you guys were born the same year, 1965.
Okay, we're both 54.
Yeah, he's January 12th.
He's a little older than me.
A little older, but
6 months older than me.
You guys grew up on the same
stuff. On the same stuff. So I can understand where he's coming from, and I hey, look, I admire that he wants to emulate those things, but man, his movies are so bad, and I can't forgive him for what he did with Halloween. I can't forgive him. It's just, I mean, that was because I hated all of his movies leading up to that. But then when I saw Halloween, I was like, okay, that's it. That's it, man. You can't defecate all over my favorite horror movie like that. You can't. Carpenter didn't. People were asking Carpenter about the remake. And the whole point was that he said Rob Zombie didn't get it. Because the whole point of that movie is that you don't know who Michael Myers is. He's a mystery. He's an enigma. He's evil.
He's the shape.
He's the shape. Don't give him a backstory. Don't give him some weird traumatic backstory as to why he started killing people. He's a guy in a white mask. That's it. He's a being. There's no explanation for why he is as evil as he is. There's no explanation for why he keeps getting up after you shoot him. And there shouldn't be. There should be no. It was the worst decision ever to try to give a backstory to Michael Myers. I don't want a backstory to Michael Myers. I don't even want to see Michael Myers' eyes. I want to see the black eye holes in the mask. That's what I want. But anyway, so to get back to Sid Haig, who we're talking about here, if you guys want to jump in, if you're a fan of Sid Haig, if you're you know, you've seen, you know, some of these movies, and he's a character actor, like I said, hundreds and hundreds of TV appearances and in movies and everything. If you want to jump in here, if you're a horror fan and you want to talk a little bit about Sid Haig, we would love to do that. So we'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll get some phone calls here and some texts. Send them in now at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. More remembering Sid Haig and going through the many, many credits that he has. And some really, there's one movie in particular that I want to talk about that he made in the 60s, which was the first, I think it was the first movie ever made with Jack Hill. Jack Hill, still alive. Jack Hill's still alive. God bless him. He made a series of incredible blaxploitation films in the 70s that were just awesome. He was a great genre filmmaker, and at the height of his insane career in the 70s, he made a bunch of these sort of genre blaxploitation, exploitation movies, and Sid Haig appeared in a few of them. But the first one that he ever did was in the 60s with Jack Hill, and it's a crazy movie. It's a crazy movie, and I want to talk about that one for sure when we get back. So Sid Haig passed away. We want to remember him. 312-981-7200. I shot the sheriff. Very specific era of Clapton's career that this listener chose. That's mid-70s Clapton right there. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Skyline studio. It's 2 o'clock. It's not 2 o'clock. Well, it's 2:19. It is 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. Get your request in now. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. So we're going to jump into after the 2:30 news. Today, in the year 1789, the first Supreme Court was established. We'll talk a little bit about that piece of history. And then we're going to get into the best legal dramas on TV and the best legal movies, courtroom movies and courtroom TV shows. And then Phil Hartman would have been 71 years old today. So a little bit later on, we're going to remember the great Phil Hartman, the truly, truly great Phil Hartman, and talk about his really incredible career and some of the funniest stuff that he did on Saturday Night Live and on TV and in movies. And he would have been 71 today. So we just want to celebrate Phil Hartman, who is my favorite Saturday Night Live cast member ever. So now we're celebrating another person who we lost. We lost him over the weekend, and that's Sid Haig. Sid Haig was 80. He was a horror and genre movie icon. Character actor, and he passed away over the weekend, and he's been in hundreds of movies and TV shows, and a very memorable actor. And I want to get to some of his credits here. Let's talk a little bit about them. Now, after you saw House of a Thousand Corpses, did you specifically go, this Captain Spaulding guy, I like him, and I want to see him in other stuff?
Well, I was a big fan of him and Bill Moseley.
Yeah.
And luckily, Bill Moseley led me to Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2 and his performance as Chop Top.
His performance in that movie is fantastic.
It is so underrated, and that whole movie is so underrated as a satire of its own genre.
It is a certifiably nuts movie.
It is.
It is certifiably insane. But yeah, Chop Top is, he's great in that movie. I mean, I think that's like an iconic horror character.
Yeah, it really is, yeah. Especially for the diehards. For Sid Haig, I didn't really. I thought Captain Spaulding was super cool, and when I ended up seeing The Devil's Rejects, I was like, yeah, this is cool. He's back. It's still not. It didn't blow me away as much as seeing House of a Thousand Corpses at, you know, 12
years old.
It's going to do things to you, but. I ended up going down the blaxploitation route, and that's when I saw him with Pam Grier and stuff like he was in Coffee.
Coffee. Yeah, he was in The Big Birdcage. He did a lot of those blaxploitation movies in the 70s, and he always played like a freak or a villain or a thug.
And, of course, he got back together with Pam Grier in Jackie Brown because he plays the judge, correct?
Yeah, he's in Jackie Brown.
Yeah, so
he's also
really
in Kill
nice.
Bill. He's also in both Kill Bills. But the movie I first want to mention here, we had a text here, and the texter mentions it, was the first movie he did with Jack Hill, who would go on to direct those series of blaxploitation movies in the 70s. This is a movie they made in 1967. Sid Haig, they said it's their 301 area code, sends in a text. You guys can jump in anytime, 312-981-7200, talk and text. Sid Haig was in so many things, but I always remember him that he was a villain on the Saturday morning show Jason of the Star Command. Yes, he was. And this is the movie I want to talk about. Our texter mentions it, a cult classic weird film, Spider Baby. Now, have you seen Spider Baby?
I have not.
Oh, man. Spider Baby, or The Maddest Story Ever Told, is its full title. It's from 1967, and it was one of the last movies that Lon Chaney Jr. made. I think he made about five movies after this one. It is about as weird a movie as you can possibly imagine. It takes place like in this rural mansion where this inbred family has just lost their patriarch, and the main guy played by Lon Chaney Jr. decides he wants to take care of his three insane siblings. So it's just this, I mean, it is weird. It's especially weird to see Lon Chaney Jr. in it, because Lon Chaney Jr., as he got a little bit older, he did make weirder movies, and he made a lot of movies as he started to age more. But this is, I think, the weirdest. And Sid Haig plays one of the siblings in it, and it's one of these movies that when you see it, you go, "What?" It's a very, very hard movie to describe. Shot in black and white. And just like the whole style of the movie was weird. It was low budget. Lon Chaney Jr. was not in great shape when they made the movie, and Sid Haig was young. And it is sometimes billed as a comedy because it's so weird, it's funny. But if you've not seen Spider Baby, if you want to be a little adventurous, you know, I would say check out Spider Baby. And I think you should see it for sure, Tom.
Yeah, it seems right up my alley. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I crave. Yeah. And I did manage to find a quote from Michael Wilmington, the
Tribune. Oh, sure. Used to be a critic here for the Trib.
Yeah. A very good critic. But this is what he has to say about Spider Baby, which he gave 2.5 stars. One of those lurid, macabre, amusingly exaggerated B-horror movies beloved by the psychotronic / Joe Bob Briggs crowds. Two sexy but psychotic spider-loving baby-talking sisters and their bald, crazed idiot brother all living in what looks like the Bates Mansion.
That's it.
I don't know what...
That's
it. Is there a better selling point?
That's it. That sums it all up.
If you invoke the name Joe Bob Briggs, you know I'm going to watch it.
Yeah. No, you got to see it. I'm actually surprised you haven't seen it. All right. Some of the other movies that that Sid Haig starred in. He was in Bone Tomahawk. He's one of those go-to guys for people making those kind of movies. He was in The Lords of Salem, Hatchet 3, The Brotherhood of Blood, the Haunted Casino. Some of these names are great. The Little Big Top. Let's see. Jackie Brown, obviously we mentioned. Genuine Risk, The Forbidden Dance. He was in the TV show Just the 10 of Us, if you can imagine him on a wacky sitcom. Appeared on Scarecrow and Mrs. King. And but now, so in the 70s, though, he had a string of movies, including these blaxploitation films. He was on episodes of Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. He was a regular on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. He was on the TV series Monster Squad, which is not related to the movie.
No.
From the 80s. He was in Swashbuckler. He was in Run, Joe, Run. He made an appearance on Get Christy Love. He was on $6 Million Man, Savage Sisters, Foxy Brown, Busting, Shaft, The Don is Dead, Coffee, Emperor of the North, which is a great movie. Do you know Emperor of the North?
Yeah, you've mentioned it before. We've...
Lee Marvin plays a hobo.
Yeah.
Ernest Borgnine plays an insane conductor on a train who beats hobos with hammers because he doesn't want them riding on their train. Robert Aldridge directed it. It's a classic. He was in The Big Birdcage. He was in Beware the Blob, The Woman Hunt, Black Mama, White Mama. See, these are the titles that I care about. The Big Dollhouse. He also appeared, CC and Company with Joe Namath, but he also appeared in George Lucas's first film, THX 1138.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So,
a man of a thousand faces.
I mean, yeah. And worked up until his death. He's got, you know what? He's passed away, but he's working on three movies right now. I just want
to... You know, good for him.
One is filming and two are in pre-production. The last movie that he will be seen in, Three from Hell just came out, but he's in a film that was just completed called Hanukkah. And Obadiah Lazarus, the son of Judah Lazarus, the original Hanukkah killer. In 1983, Judah terrorized New York for 7 nights and was preparing to sacrifice their 8-year-old son. And he plays the father. So there you go. You can see it. It's a horror movie called Hanukkah. I can't believe they haven't made a horror movie named Hanukkah already. They've covered all the other holidays. How do they not cover Hanukkah?
Coming next summer, President's Day.
And you have to go to the IMDb page for the movie. They spell it with the H, so it's H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H. And look at the poster. I just want you to look at the poster art when you see it. You'll know what I'm talking about when you see it. So, do you see the poster art?
Good Lord.
Do you think they've seen Friday the 13th?
Probably.
All right, we got a break here. And when we come back, we are going to talk about the fact that today is the first Supreme Court was established. And we're going to talk about courtroom movies, legal dramas, TV shows as well. 312-981-7200. The news is up after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 1 to 5 a.m., keeping you company throughout the morning. And, Two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, Two for Tuesday. Yeah. And One Artist, Two Songs, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Who requested that?
That's coming to us from Lulu. It's a little Ellie Goulding.
Oh, okay.
The song is Lights.
All right. Well, there you go. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. I want to hear from you guys about your favorite or the best legal movies and best legal TV dramas of all time. Courtroom stuff on both TV and movies. 312-981-7200. What are your favorites? In 1789, on this date, September 24th, the first Supreme Court is established. The Judiciary Act of 1789 is passed by Congress and signed by President George Washington, establishing the Supreme Court of the United States as a tribunal made up of 6 justices who were to serve the court until death or retirement. That day, President Washington nominated John Jay to preside as Chief Justice, John Rutledge, William Cushing, John Blair, and Robert Harrison, and James Wilson to be associate justices. On September 26, all 6 appointments were confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And the U.S. Supreme Court was established by Article 3 in the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution granted the Supreme Court ultimate jurisdiction over all laws, especially those in which their constitutionality was at issue. The High Court was also designed to oversee cases concerning treaties of the United States, foreign diplomats, and maritime jurisdiction. February 1st, 1790, the first session of the Supreme Court was held in New York City's Royal Exchange Building. The U.S. Supreme Court grew into the most important judicial body in the world in terms of its central place in the American political order. According to the Constitution, the size of the court is set by Congress, and the number of judges varied during the 19th century before stabilizing in 1869 at 9. In times of constitutional crisis, the nation's highest court has always played a definitive role in resolving, for better or worse, the great issues of our time. So that happened on this date in 1789. So we thought we would get legal here this morning and talk about some of the best legal movies of all time and some of the best legal TV shows and dramas, courtroom dramas. Now, I remember at one point in an episode of Cop Rock where they were in the middle of a trial. And the entire courtroom, including the judges and everybody, the judge, the jury, everybody, began dancing and singing. And I remember thinking it was one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen. And I remember that the 12 members of the jury had a pretty significantly complicated dance routine that was choreographed. But that was Cop Rock. You know, Cop Rock, you can see scenes from Cop Rock on YouTube. Have you ever sat down and watched some Cop Rock?
Oh, I've had the distinct pleasure.
Yeah. That wasn't a joke. That was like a real idea. And I'm trying to remember because somebody the person who created that show, the guy who created Cop Rock, like, is one of those legendary sort of TV producers that has created, you know, that keeps creating good shows and hits after hits. I think it was Stephen Bochco.
It was.
Okay. Stephen Bochco.
Created possibly one of the greatest cop dramas of all time, Hill Street Blues,
yeah.
Which revolutionized the way that television programs looked.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he did Cop Rock.
NYPD Blue.
No, I mean, no, his credits are ridiculous. Stephen Bochco is one of those guys that you look back at the TV shows that he's created, and the guy has created some legendary stuff.
Including, probably his crowning achievement, Doogie Howser, M.D.
Yeah. So, I've got here some of the best TV legal dramas. So if you guys want to jump in here, we would love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're doing both TV and movies. So I'm going to be switching back and forth between those two. And we're talking courtroom or TV legal stuff. Here's the first one that they mentioned, Bull. I've got to say, I've never seen Bull. I see commercials for it all the time because it's on CBS and I watch Big Brother. And so I'm going to see a commercial for Bull every 14 seconds.
And it's got that one guy from NCIS.
Yeah. Michael Weatherly's Bull, a CBS drama that debuted in 2016, is currently in its third season. The show gives a different perspective of the legal world as it follows a jury consulting firm headed by Michael's character, psychologist and trial science expert, Dr. Jason Bull. This show, which shines a light on complicated juror selection process, gets points for its unique angle. Dan Feinberg, not a fan of Bull.
Well, I know there's been some on-set issues with Mr. Weatherly as well.
Yeah. There have been some behind-the-scenes stuff. And in fact, people are really, like Feinberg, Dan Feinberg, who we spoke to earlier about the Emmys this morning, is shocked that it's still on. Like, the ratings are really good for it. As far as, like, broadcast TV ratings go, it's pretty strong. Lots of people watch it. So, I've never seen it. I've just seen commercials for it.
I think a lot of it has to do with the pull of Michael Weatherly himself.
Yeah.
Who established quite a bit of a fan base with his time on NCIS.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if people like you enough, they'll just keep watching.
Yeah. Okay, next one that they talk about here is The Night Of. This was brilliant. The Night Of was brilliant. It might have only run for one season, but it hooked audiences with its gritty, realistic depiction of legal system and how it shined a light on the hardships of downtrodden defense attorney. Riz Ahmed starred on the HBO series as Naz Khan, a college student accused of murdering a girl that he met the same night that he was driving in her cab, with John Turturro playing the aforementioned defense attorney, John Stone. The show depicts what can go wrong in America's criminal justice system. Innocent Naz's life is ruined as he spends time in prison and his trial ends with a deadlocked jury. The acting in that was so good. And Turturro goes without saying, but Turturro was great on that show. And that was that's a great example of it. 847 area code says my favorite legal scene in a movie has got to be My Cousin Vinny. That's, I think, one of the best courtroom movies ever made. I love that movie. You know, I love it. Everything about that movie is just great. Every performance is good. It's really smartly written. My Cousin Vinny is one of those movies that really surprised me, because Joe Pesci had just done a movie called The Super, which was this terrible, wacky sort of slapstick comedy where he played like a slumlord, which is a wacky premise right in of itself. And it was awful. And so this was these were his follow-ups. This was his follow-up to like Goodfellas. And I'm like, what? And then I start seeing commercials and trailers for this My Cousin Vinny. And I'm like, oh, God. If it's half as bad as, you know, The Super, oh. So I was not looking forward to it. And I can't explain to you how surprised I was at the quality of My Cousin Vinny. I thought it was just going to be New York stereotype taking on Southern stereotype, both of which are going to be sort of insultingly portrayed. Like, hey, look at the New Yorker. He's in the South. The people in the South are dumb, and the people from New York are dumb. Look at these two dumb stereotypes. And that's what I thought it was going to be, but it's not. It wasn't that at all. Every character, no matter where they were from, what place they were from, whether they were the New Yorkers who were the fish out of water, or whether they were the Southerners, were all treated with intelligence. And it's really smartly written. And I just didn't expect. I just did not expect that at all. I didn't. And I love that movie. I love it. And I think it's a great courtroom movie too. You so root for Joe Pesci in it. And there's Ralph Macchio playing like a supporting part in it, and I love him in it. Austin Pendleton, who shows up as the stuttering lawyer, is just amazing in it. Bruce McGill is fantastic in it. And, Joe Pesci obviously is great. Marissa Tomei won the Academy Award, deservedly so, because she's brilliant and funny in it. And come on, man, Fred Gwynne. What are we talking about here? What's a Ute? That's one of those movies. That's a remote dropper for me.
Oh yeah,
absolutely a remote dropper. Anytime I'm flipping around cable and my cousin Vinny is on, I drop the remote and I watch it.
I mean, that's how I saw it. It just happened to be on cable.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. Well, it didn't seem to me like it was going. I won't lie, it didn't seem like it was going to be any good. And of course, I was wrong. Very, very wrong. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yeah.
It to me, Joe Pesci, at that point, I hadn't seen Goodfellas or anything, way too young.
Yeah.
The only thing I had seen was Lethal Weapon on cable.
Oh, God.
So to me, Joe Pesci was Leo Getz.
So he was wacky already.
Yeah.
So like you had not seen like when he acted like for real. Well, I mean, he acted for real in My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
But like, so you didn't see Raging Bull. You didn't see Goodfellas.
No, wait. I mean, just wasn't ready for it. I've obviously seen them since.
Yeah.
But I was not ready for that, and then Joe Pesci became, one of the greats.
Yeah, he's Joe Pesci.
But it's nice that he has such a range that he can just be, I don't know, wacky, strange.
Yeah,
just
but the thing about My Cousin Vinny is that the acting in that movie is great. Like, it's legitimately great. It's not like wacky, over the top, one dimensional comedy, slapstick, loud nonsense. These are real characters. That's one of the things that I really, really love about My Cousin Vinny is that they're really, really, really real characters, like fully developed three dimensional characters. And I did not expect that when I came in. So yeah, a nice choice. 847 area code says my favorite has to be My Cousin Vinny. And I'm sure that I have an article here with the best legal movies of all time in front of me, and I'm sure it'll be mentioned. I'm sure that we will hear it again. 773 area code says, how about some good law shows? Perry Mason. Perry Mason is classic. L.A. Law, The Defenders, Boston Legal, Matlock, JAG. And that's from Bakery Guy. I don't think, because that's at the end of the text here, is Bakery Guy. I don't think Bakery Guy was a lawyer show.
I'd watch Bakery Guy in a lawyer show.
Bakery Guy.
Bakery Law.
Defending those who bake. They mentioned Matlock. Matlock! That's my Abe Simpson. I love the fact that the senior citizens in Springfield are obsessed with Matlock. The classic legal drama Matlock, the show centered around Andy Griffith's character Ben Matlock, a top-of-the-line criminal defense attorney who studied at Harvard Law. Matlock was expensive to hire but would defend his client often by discovering the real perpetrator and confronting them in those iconic courtroom scenes. The show began airing in 1996 and it ran for an amazing 9 seasons. And what they don't mention here is that they reunited him and Don Knotts for several episodes. He and Don Knotts worked together again. It was
really?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was Andy and Barney Fife together again.
Because I've only seen a little bit of Matlock just on rerun. But
yeah.
I mean it's great.
Yeah. Matlock.
That's and you said Andy Griffith?
Andy Griffith and Don. Well, Don Knotts wasn't a regular. I mean, he was a semi regular.
He would just show up every.
Yeah, because he's Barney Fife. You want to see Andy Griffith and Barney Fife together again?
Yeah.
And they actually in one episode of Matlock. They recreate an episode, or they recreate a scene, like shot for shot, from an episode of Andy Griffith's show. So.
Andy Griffith is a special person in our household because my grandfather, who I'm named after, the Tom Hush the Elder,
yeah,
as it were, is a dead ringer for Andy Griffith.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. If you saw a picture of my dad, you'd be like, oh, he kind of looks like a heavier set Andy Griffith, a.k.a. Matlock.
Yeah. Well, have you ever seen the movie Waitress?
Yeah.
Andy Griffith is great in that.
He's the old guy with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, and he's the old guy who hangs out in the diner.
Yeah.
Carrie Russell, so good in that movie. Oh, man, she's so good.
Hi, I'm Carrie Russell, and I love Nick's radio show.
I know you do, baby. Okay, we're going to break here, and we'll get back, and we're talking about TV and movie, courtroom movies, legal movies. Which ones are your favorite? Which ones are the best? Most memorable? 312-981-7200. We're also going to remember Phil Hartman, who would have turned 71 today. And we're going to remember his great career and how brilliant and funny he was. So that's all coming up. But jump in here on your on the courtroom movies and TV shows. 312-981-7200. Right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? It's Nick DiGilio. I'm your overnight dude here till 5 a.m. every weekday morning. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. You made 2 for Tuesday. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on WGN. All right, we are talking about courtroom shows and movies and legal TV shows and legal movies. Which ones are the best? 312-981-7200. Bunch of texts have come in, and we got some people on the phone, so let's get to you guys. Here's Bruce on WGN. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, how you doing, Nick? What's up, buddy?
All right.
I love the movies A Few Good Men and JFK.
Ah, yes. Yeah, JFK does qualify. I mean, JFK is much more sprawling than your usual courtroom, but it does. The whole thing depends on the case.
It's like 5 hours long, too.
It's a very long movie. Very long movie. And A Few Good Men, of course, is iconic.
Tom Cruise, Demi Moore, Jack Nicholson, awesome.
Yep. Kevin Bacon is in that. That's got an all-star cast. So, all right, very good. Thank you, Bruce.
Yep.
Okay, I saw A Few Good Men on stage first because it was Aaron Sorkin. It's a play. And I saw it here in Chicago on stage. I thought the play was great. But the movie, Rob Reiner did a really good job with that movie. Mm-hmm. You can't argue that cast either.
And plus, I mean, this.
You can't handle the truth.
Yeah.
Classic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a good movie. A really, really, really good movie. JFK, not a fan.
I think JFK is good.
Yeah.
I would usually see it on TV a lot.
Yeah. It's Oliver Stone and I'm not.
Good old Ollie.
I run very cold on Oliver Stone. There are a few movies that he's made that I like. But for the most part, I'm like, man, shut up. And JFK is one of those movies.
Yeah.
So.
Platoon's not bad.
Platoon is good until the last 5 minutes. The monologue at the end, it's like, in case you're a moron and you haven't watched the last 2 hours of this movie, let me just shove this down your throat again. And that's the thing I hate about Oliver Stone. I like directors who aren't known for their subtlety. I'm a big Brian De Palma fan. But I can't stand, for some reason, it bugs me when Oliver Stone does it. You know, Brian De Palma is one of my favorite directors on the planet. And there is not a subtle bone in that man's body. And in fact, a lot of directors I like, Argento. There's nothing subtle about Dario Argento. But for some reason, I think it's because, because Oliver Stone always feels like he's got to have something to say. Like it's a message movie. Whereas De Palma is just about, it's over the top and it's not subtle, but he's not saying anything. You know what I mean? 301 area code. We got some text coming in at 312-981-7200. A great courtroom drama, Anatomy of a Murder. I mean, please. Please.
Top 10 movie posters as
Otto
well.
Otto Preminger, Jimmy Stewart. They don't make them like that anymore. And I know I sound like an old man, but they don't. 815, another vote for JAG.
Big fans of JAG.
You know who was a big fan of JAG?
Who?
Ron Santo.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, we played a clip. I used to do this thing when we broadcast the Cubs here on WGN. I used to do this thing called the Pat and Ron Show, where people would listen, like we do on Fridays. When people listen, if someone mentions my name, you know, you jot it down and we play it back on Friday. If someone says something out of context, we do that. We play it back on Friday. Well, we used to do this thing every Sunday night where we would play back highlights from the week's Cub games and when Pat and Ron got funny. And back in our office, Tom, I have hours and hours of clips of Pat and Ron on mini discs. And we used to play them. And one of them was about, they had a lengthy discussion about how much Ron liked Jag. And the reason he liked Jag, as Ron would go on to say, is because he enjoyed the woman who was on Jag. And that's the beautiful Catherine Bell, who is stunning. And so, you know, that was something that Ron and I had in common. We both thought Catherine Bell was sort of jaw-droppingly hot. And so he was talking about it, and Pat maintained that he was not familiar with the show. He was like, Jag? Is there? And he's like, it's a good show. And Ron's trying to explain it, and he's not doing very well trying to explain it. And so Pat keeps asking him questions, and one of the questions was there someone on the show named Jag? And Ron goes, no, there's no one on the show named Jag. And he goes, what do you mean? No, there's not like Larry Jag? Larry Jag. So now, as far as I'm concerned, anytime I talk about that show, the main character is Larry Jag.
God, what does Jag stand for?
It stands for, I don't know. Look it up.
They're military cops.
Yeah, it's military. Right? It's a military court show. And I think NCIS, one of those shows is a spinoff of Jag. There is a spinoff. Jag has a spinoff.
Yeah, NCIS spawned the hit series NCIS.
Right. What does Jag stand for?
Judge Advocate General.
There you go.
U.S. military acronym.
Right. Larry Jag.
get Jag in here.
Yeah.
In my office now, right. Jag.
Who do you think you are, Jag?
Turn in your stars, Jag. I won't have it.
Larry, get out of my office.
What's it take to be a Jag in this world?
Man. 405 area code says, two courtroom films that I love are Class Action with Gene Hackman. I only saw that once. I don't remember liking it very much. And the other is A Time to Kill with your guy, Matthew McConaughey. Another one of the very few good Joel Schumacher movies.
Was that McConaughey's follow-up to Dazed and Confused?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the one that established him. That's the one, you know, he's got that monologue. He's got like a 5-minute monologue at the end of the movie. That became sort of like his calling card. You know, when there's like one specific scene in a movie where someone just like takes it, owns it. I mean, we could do a whole topic on that, like scenes where someone just breaks out and becomes like Eddie Murphy in 48 Hours when he goes into the redneck bar. That's it. He was a movie star. He became a movie star. Matthew McConaughey does that monologue at the end of A Time to Kill. Boom. Welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome. I bet there's got to be more of those that we can probably think of. Like,
yeah.
Actors or actresses who just kill it and you go, who's that?
Yeah.
I can think of, here's one. Here's one. It's a courtroom movie. Edward Norton, Primal Fear.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. First movie. Here's another first movie, like, where you take it and you own it.
Yeah.
Alan Rickman's first movie was Die Hard. If you can believe that, like right out of the gate, he plays Hans Gruber. Like, how is that possible? So, all right, let's break here. We got the news coming up, and then we'll jump back into it. We got a ton of texts coming in, and we want you to join us, too. We're doing TV courtroom and movie courtroom stuff. 312-981-7200.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. Called Lee Ho Fooks. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein.
Not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Just wanted to let everybody know that. Warren Zevon, one of the greatest singer-songwriters in the history of anything. Never been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
But he does have great taste in Chinese food.
Yeah. Def Leppard's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Just want to let people know that. Bon Jovi's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Warren Zevon has never been nominated. Just wanted to let everybody know. I get so pissed off every time I think about that. Who requested the Zevon?
The Zevon is coming to us from Bruce.
All right, Bruce, good job. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're talking about courtroom dramas and courtroom movies and courtroom TV shows. 312-981-7200. Doc says, Nick, I love Primal Fear, and I still think that Edward Norton got robbed when Cuba Gooding Jr. won Best Supporting Actor. Yeah. Yeah.
But think of all the good stuff he's done since, like Snow Dogs.
Yeah.
Or some other one like that.
Wasn't he on, like, The Crazy Boat or something?
Is that a television
Was he in
show?
Soul Plane?
Was he in Soul Plane? That's a good question.
Snoop Dogg is your pilot.
I know he was in Rat Race.
He was in Rat Race.
Genius comedy.
But, hey, listen. No, I still think he's a good actor. I mean, he was fantastic as OJ on the miniseries. Mm-hmm. He was great. I like Cuba Gooding Jr. And you know what? To be fair, he's great in Jerry Maguire. He's great in it. It's a terrific performance. But it's not as good as Edward Norton's performance in Primal Fear. Also, my wife and I still use a line from that movie. When one of us finally gets something that is so painfully obvious, the other claps a couple of times and says, "Way to go, Marty."
Does one of you also have a split personality?
Primal Fear is a really good movie. It's a really good movie. Shot here in Chicago. Mahoney's in it. Laura Linney. Gear. But that's one of the most insane film debuts I've ever seen with Edward Norton. He was unbelievable in it. Canadian Bill says, I'm a fan of David E. Kelly. From the Hip to The Practice to Boston Legal. You ever see From the Hip?
No, it was From the Hip.
It's a Judd Nelson vehicle.
Oh, boy.
He plays a lawyer. He plays a hip lawyer. It's a courtroom movie. I'm trying to remember the female lead. I want to say it was Elizabeth Perkins. It's actually a pretty good movie. I think Bob Clark directed it, if I'm not mistaken. But it's like from the 80s. It's Judd Nelson.
Yeah, Bob Clark. And it is Judd Nelson and Elizabeth Perkins.
Elizabeth Perkins.
John Hurt.
Yeah. No, it's actually a pretty enjoyable movie.
Hmm. Okay.
Nice little little vehicle for the Judd Nelson.
I like the poster. Getting to the top means working like a dog, and Judd Nelson is in a suit with a dog bone in his mouth.
I don't think that was the original poster art. I think that was your video art.
Yeah.
608 area code says, I loved the show Shark. It starred James Woods, who played a big-name L.A. defense attorney, who, when confronted by the fact that one of his clients is actually guilty, switches sides to the DA office, taking on high-profile cases. Okay. Let's see. Here's Mark on WGN. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
I called about the... You ever see The Star Chamber with Michael Douglas?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, that was good back in the early 80s, I think it was.
Yeah. That's a Peter Himes movie, if I'm not mistaken, directed that one. Yeah, no, that's a really good movie. And it kind of puts you in a very weird moral position. You know what I mean? So,
I agree.
Yeah, it's a good one, Mark. Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
You ever see Star Chamber? So this is a movie where Michael Douglas plays a judge, okay? And this is Peter Himes. Peter Himes is the director of this movie, Chicagoan. He did Capricorn 1. For God's sake, he did Capricorn 1. So the plot of this movie, this is 1983 this movie came out. The plot of the movie is Michael Douglas plays a judge who is really sick and tired of letting obviously guilty people off on weird technicalities. So he keeps losing sleep over it. He gets upset about it because he's got to let these people go. These criminals are allowed to go free because of these weird rules and these technicalities. in the way that they were arrested or booked or the way that their case turns out. And these, you know, lawyers are doing everything they can to get these guys off. And so he gets really sick of it, and he confides in a buddy of his who is an older gentleman who is like a mentor to him, and he's played by Hal Holbrook. And Hal Holbrook lets Michael Douglas in on a secret. Other judges are also sick and tired of letting criminals, obviously guilty criminals, off on these technicalities. So what they do is they meet this group of judges. They meet, they add Michael Douglas to this group, and what they do is they each bring a case to them, to the other judges. They call it the Star Chamber, and they're in this room, and so each judge brings in a case. They present it to the other judges in the room, and then they decide whether or not these people are guilty. They decide whether or not they should have gone to jail, that it's obvious that they're guilty, and that it was completely unfair of the way the law system is set up that these guys got off. So what they do is they pass judgment on these guys, they decide whether they're guilty or not, and then they get a hitman to kill them. So that's the setup of the movie, The Star Chamber. And again, it's a little morally confusing, a movie, because you don't know where from. But it's a really terrific film, and not a lot of people saw it. It wasn't like it was a big hit or anything like that. So, yeah. Anyway, so that's The Star Chamber, and it's definitely worth seeing. It's definitely worth seeing. So, Mark, thanks for bringing that one up. Hey, Nick, I like the 1959 Paul Newman movie, The Young Philadelphians. That's a terrific movie. Robert Vaughn got a supporting actor nomination. I'm also partial to the TV legal shows of the 70s, like The Young Lawyers with Zalman King, Owen Marshall, Counselor at Law, and The Bold Ones with James Farentino. 815 area code throws some titles out here. Fracture, Anatomy of a Murder, 12 Angry Men, and The Verdict. God, The Verdict is so good. So good. Directed by Lumet, written by Mamet, Paul Newman, please.
What a trio.
God. 724 area code says the original Helter Skelter movie. Yeah, there's some creepy stuff that happens in the courtroom during that movie. Ghosts of Mississippi, and of course A Few Good Men, they all have memorable courtroom scenes. 847 area code, has anyone mentioned Absence of Malice? That's another one of those movies that flew under the radar. Absence of Malice. It's Paul Newman, Sally Field. From the 80s, 82, I want to say. I think it was directed by Sidney Pollack. I think it was Sidney Pollack who directed it. It's a good movie. 815, obviously, the To Kill a Mockingbird. 636 area code says To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, that's, you know, obviously, you know, I've got an article here with the 30 best legal movies of all time. To Kill a Mockingbird's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is.
And Absence of Malice, yeah, directed by Sidney Pollack.
Was Pollack directed that one?
Yeah, Newman and Sally Field.
Yeah. It's a really good movie. It is really good. Sean in Indy says, I think the discussion starts and ends with my cousin with my cousin Vinny. I don't know if it ends. Nick, this Sunday night on NCIS LA, the JAG characters are coming back, including Catherine Bell. Oh! Time to warm up that DVR.
The return of Larry JAG.
I remember when JAG was on, because it was on for like 9 seasons, that show.
Yeah, my parents watched JAG every single week.
Oh, they did?
Oh, because my God, did they love JAG.
Here's the thing. I didn't know anybody who watched JAG. Nobody. Nobody I knew watched JAG. But it was on for like 8 seasons, and it's one of those shows where it's like, who the hell, who's watching this show? How is it possible this show is still on? No one I know, not one single person I know, watches JAG. So I'm online at the Jewels one day, when they used to have the magazine racks up by the Jewels. Well, they still do, but nobody buys them anymore. And they had, you remember the magazine Stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a Maxim.
Oh, it's like a Maxim.
Yeah, it was a cheesecake magazine like Maxim. So it was, you know, Jennifer Love Hewitt in bikinis and all this stuff.
Yeah, not quite Playboy, but
no, it's there. There's the women are very scantily clad and everything. Mm-hmm. And so I'm standing online, you know, and they've got your Maxim, and then there was this stuff, which I think may have been from the same publisher as Maxim. I mean, essentially the same magazine. It was a cheesecake magazine, if you want to look at celebrities who are like almost naked. And so I'm standing in line, and I look over, and I see Catherine Bell on the cover of Stuff. And I went, whoa. So I picked it up, and I looked at I looked at the pictures inside, and I went, oh, now I know why people watch JAG. That was when I realized, oh, it's because of this woman who is making my knees weak as I stand in the jewel line looking at Stuff magazine.
I'll have you know, Nick, that I watched JAG with my parents for the biting and gripping legal drama.
Sure.
How dare you?
Yeah. Let's see. Hey, Nick, I just got into the truck heading to work. Didn't know if you mentioned, but A Few Good Men, Philadelphia, and The Accused are some of my favorite courtroom movies. The Accused is a great movie. Great movie. Jonathan Kaplan directed that one. That's the first time, it's the first Academy Award Jodie Foster won, was for The Accused. Not an easy movie to watch. So, let's see. Here's Steve on WGN. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, I'm here, Nick.
Yeah.
I had two of them, but I don't remember the name. One was McConaughey, who was defending that rich guy who was killing a girl, and he did it, but and his mom was a whack job. He tried to protect him. And said he got him off at the end. He ended up going. There was a biker gang in there with his buddy. I don't remember. It's not that old.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it.
Is it Lincoln Lawyer?
I'm sorry?
The Lincoln Lawyer. I think you're talking about the Lincoln Lawyer.
That could be it. That was the county. And then my other one was when Hackman was part of the jury and the two guys, the couple was trying to get on the jury against the gun company. And Hackman was trying to control the jury for the gun company, and the guy got on the jury to help so they wouldn't get persuaded. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
That was a good movie, too.
Yeah, Civil Action, I think that might have been called. No, that's the Civil Action was with Travolta.
No, that's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember what it was called, but they were picking the jury. It's kind of like watching Bull, you know?
Yeah.
They picked the jury, and the one kid got on the jury to help so they wouldn't get it kicked up. You know, the one they find out was a drunk. She got kicked. If they were trying to pick out the people for the drink. I can't remember the name.
Okay, well, somebody might know. All right, Steve, thanks, man.
All right, bud.
Lincoln Lawyer.
Could it possibly be the Runaway Jury?
Runaway Jury. That's it.
Yeah.
Is it Demi Moore?
Let's see here.
Is it Demi Moore? Because that's the.
Yeah, I've got Rachel Weisz.
Rachel Weisz.
Yeah. So that's John Cusack.
Oh wait,
Dean
she
Hackman.
Was in the. She was in the Juror.
Yeah,
Demi Moore was in The Juror.
Yeah, this is John Cusack, Gene Hackman, Dustin Hoffman, Rachel Weisz.
That's the one. All right, we're going to take a break here, and we come back, and we're talking more legal movies, and we're going to remember the great Phil Hartman coming up a little later as well. As this listener did this on purpose. It's the only song by Warren Zevon I hate.
I don't know how that's possible.
Because it sucks. Nighttime at the shipping yard.
Oh my God. The guitar, it just bounces.
I hate that song.
It'll get the static out of your clothes.
And my friends who are in Androgynous Mustache, my good friend Chris Anderson and the other guys, when they perform that song for Warren Zevon's birthday celebration, which they do every January, even if I'm not there, they dedicate it to me because they know I can't stand that song. And then they play like a 15-minute version of it. I remember the first time I saw them do their Warren Zevon birthday tribute. This was at Quenchers. Remember Quenchers? Fullerton and Western? I used to love that bar when I was a drinking man. But I remember the first time that I went to see them do the birthday tribute. They busted out Nighttime at the Switching Yard. So I had to text my friend Scott Oaken, who shares the opinion that that's a terrible song. And I was like, let me just explain something to you. They're playing Nighttime at the Switching Yard. So. But still, Warren Zevon, not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. never been nominated. We are talking legal TV shows and legal movies, courtroom stuff. Here are some of the other ones we got. Boston Legal has been mentioned. Nobody has mentioned Ally McBeal. Ally McBeal brought a little bit of irreverent comedy to the legal world. Who could forget that dancing baby? Calista Flockhart played the titular role of a lawyer who starts at a new firm where she works alongside her now married ex-boyfriend, Billy Thomas, who's played by Gil Bellows. His wife, Georgia, played by Courtney Thorne-Smith, also joins the practice, making things even more awkward. So David E. Kelly did that one. Let's see. Here is Gary on WGN. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Nick. How are you doing tonight?
All right.
How are you doing this morning?
What's up?
Good. Have you ever seen the movie? It's a thriller courtroom drama called Body of Evidence.
Sure. Madonna, Willem Dafoe. Yeah.
I just love that movie. I saw it the other night again on DVD.
I haven't seen it in years. I haven't seen it since it came out. But
it's good to renew it because, I mean, renew yourself to it. It's just great.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a very, very long time. I remember not liking it, but I happen to love Madonna, so maybe I should watch it again. So,
okay.
All right, Gary, thanks, man.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
All right, take care. Yeah, Body of Evidence. I remember when that came out because it came out right around the same time as Madonna's Sex Book. If I remember correctly, I think that was right around the same time as Madonna's Sex Book. And so she was everywhere. And yeah. How about this? Suits. So this USA drama isn't exactly realistic. New York City lawyer Harvey Specter hires Mike Ross as an associate despite his lack of a law degree. But the show still sucks us in and allows us to suspend reality while watching. Duchess Megan was on the show. She played a paralegal who ends up falling for Mike. So the show is equal parts legal drama and soap opera, which is great for entertainment value. Yeah, Suits has been, I think Suits is in its final season on USA. And they've just added somebody to the cast. Like a movie star is on Suits now.
Wasn't the princess was on Suits?
Who? That's what I was just saying.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know, I think, you know who it is? It's Katherine Heigl. She's on
really?
Suits now. I think she's on Suits now. I think I just saw her, because it was on, I was watching wrestling. And it was on before wrestling or after? I don't know. It was because it was on. The only thing I watch on USA is Raw or SmackDown, which is now moving to Fox.
Hell yeah!
But that's the only thing I. And now NXT, which is on Wednesdays, on USA. But they added somebody to the cast.
They did. It was Katherine Heigl. They had Katherine Heigl. Season 8, which was last year. Yeah.
Okay.
Great, Katherine Heigl.
Yeah. I used to like her years ago.
When my mom was really into Grey's Anatomy, I liked her, but then she just started going nuts.
Grey's Anatomy, as my friend Scott Oaken calls it, high school hospital, because everybody in that hospital acts like they're in high school. How about this one? How to Get Away with Murder. This married our obsessions with legal dramas and Shonda Rhimes' addictive appointment TV on ABC. The show, which premiered in 2014, chronicles a group of uncharacteristic, good-looking law students and another criminal defense professor as their lives intertwine via a crazy, complicated murder. Star Viola Davis has won Primetime Emmys and Screen Actors Guild Award for her portrayal in the show. Okay, here's one. 630 area code sends in a text, and you can send in a text too at 312-981-7200. My cousin Vinny is actually shown in many law schools. That makes sense to me. I mean, it sounds like if you hadn't seen the movie and all you know is that it's a wacky comedy with what is a Ute, you know, and Marissa Tomei, you're going to think, wait, they're going to show that in the law school? But once you see the movie, you realize that, yeah, in fact, it's a really intelligent movie that takes the law part of the movie pretty seriously, despite the fact that it's hilarious. 724 area code says, how about the hearing scene in The Godfather Part 2? Yeah. 618 area code says Night Court. Oh, yeah. I'm surprised nobody brought up Night Court earlier. It took a while to get somebody to mention Night Court. That show was funny. Harry Anderson was great. 630 area code, Scent of a Woman. Well, it does end in a courtroom. I take a flamethrower to this place. Pacino screaming through most of the movie. He won the Academy Award for that movie. Sometimes, you know, we've talked about this before. You know, they give actors the awards for the wrong movie. And, you know, they gave Al Pacino an Academy Award for Scent of a Woman. it's a bit dated in 2019, but L.A. Law was a fantastic court show. It had great actors and storylines, and I believe it was the first show to have a character with a developmental disability. I think you're right. That show was huge. I remember when L.A. Law was on. That show was massive. And then another text here, 816 area code says, liar, liar. I love that movie. I think that movie's hilarious.
It's very funny.
Very funny. Yeah, that's a courtroom movie. No question about it. I like when he's beating the crap out of himself in the bathroom. That's my favorite scene in the entire movie.
I'm a big fan of the pen thing.
Yeah. Well, all of it. He's just hilarious in it. And I also love the bloopers at the end because he's like, they're improvising. And Swoosie Kurtz was in it, who's one of my favorite character actresses. I love her. And so he starts screaming at her and calls her a name. And she goes, overactor! And then he busts out laughing just during the bloopers at the end. All right. The news is coming up next. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about TV courtroom dramas and movie courtroom dramas right here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 floors above beautiful downtown Chicago. Here until 5 a.m., 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Who requested that?
That's coming to us from Greg H., a little new order.
Okay, a little new order from Greg H. All right. So we've been talking about legal movies and courtroom dramas on TV and also comedies. And so we're getting back to this, Damages. Now, this was a show that I never watched, but I always hear great things about it. Glenn Close, you know, apparently won a bunch of awards for it. And it was everybody that I know who watched it thought it was great.
I think this falls into the category of kind of right as we're about to get into the peak TV era. Damages was just one of those dramas, one of the early dramas on FX that brought it to prominence.
Right.
I think, was it Rose Byrne that was in it?
Well, the lead was Glenn Close.
It was Glenn Close, but then she had a counterpart.
I don't remember. Speaking of FX, you know, tomorrow night, Sonny comes back on FXX. And I've seen the commercials. Have you seen the commercials for the show that's going to follow it?
No, what's the show?
It's called Cake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, clearly I'm going to DVR it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like this, a bunch of short live action and animated weird comedy pieces
mm-hmm.
that jumps between animation and live action. Natasha Lyonne is in one of them.
Yep, yep.
She bites the head off of a bird. In the scene that I saw. And then there's all this weird animation.
Yeah.
I guess it's a pretty good follow-up to Sonny, I guess, because I guess potheads watch Sonny, right?
Yeah. Sure.
I know drunks watch Sonny.
And I think Fox, and this is not the first time they've tried to do some more surreal stuff. They used to have that animation block. It was like called ADHD.
Oh, right.
It was like a really weird choice, and they did some really strange animated shows. I think they're sincerely trying to take on Adult Swim.
I'll tell you what, it made me real curious.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
when I was like, well, that looks like a really original piece of television right there. Huh? How long has Sonny been on now?
This is season 14. And it's, I believe it's renewed through at least season 16. So, I don't know, man. They're just going to keep going.
Oh, I love that. I love that show.
Their side projects keep falling by the wayside. Yeah. AP Bio got saved, but The Mick didn't stick around.
Mick was a great show. The Mick was funny as hell.
There was that awful...
I love her, man. I love Caitlin Olsen.
But there was that awful show on Fox that was produced by Charlie Day.
Oh, the old folks home show.
Yeah.
Oh!
That was like...
With like David Alan Grier. Really talented people in it. Vicki Lawrence, David Alan Grier were both in it. I watched 1.5 episodes of it. I couldn't believe how horrible it was. I don't even know the name of it. The good kids?
The cool kids.
The cool kids. Whoa. But anyway, Sonny's awesome. And I love that show. And it, like I've said before, my ex-wife Heather, when she could not watch it. She couldn't. Like, she could handle like 5 minutes of it and go, why are you watching these a-holes? These are the most despicable people I've ever seen on television. I'm like, yeah. And they're hilarious.
My girlfriend won't watch Nathan For You.
Oh, sure.
And the Eric Andre Show.
Why? Well,
because
she
thinks that they're being really mean. She doesn't like seeing comedy at people's expense like that.
I understand that. Yeah, I understand that.
Except they're hilarious.
Oh, Eric Andre Show especially.
The guy's a genius.
Eric Andre Show is hilarious. So, the cake. Man, I'm starting to lose a signal in my headphones. My left headphone has been going out a little bit. I don't want that. I love these headphones. I don't want to have to get a different pair. But I can't now. I can't hear out of my left. I can't do the... You know how some people do this? Where they...
Broadcast with one off?
With one off?
Yeah.
Can't do it.
Got to have both cameras
on. Got to have them both on. They both have to be working. So, you know how I get to take a look at this? Adam. This happened one time before, and he fixed him.
I mean, the guy's
unbelievable.
He's a wizard.
All right, we were talking about courtroom TV shows and movies. Here's James on WGN. Hi, James.
Morning, Nick. How are you this morning?
Good.
I was telling your screener about one. It was back in the early 70s, that black exploitation movie. It was with a young Larry Fishburne. He had to be no more than about maybe 10 or 12.
Yeah.
With a called Cornbread, Earl, and Me.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it. Yep.
Yeah. And I don't know if anybody has mentioned Men of Honor.
Oh, Men of Honor. No, that was not mentioned.
With Robert De Niro and Cuba Gooding.
Cuba Gooding, right. Yeah, that's a good one, too. But yeah, but Cornbread, Earl, and Me, man, I haven't seen that movie in years, but I loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I have that one on DVD. I actually found it in a double set with that at Cooley High.
Yeah. Cooley High, that's another great movie. Those are great.
Yeah.
All right, James, thanks, man.
Have a good one, Nick.
Okay, take care. All right. Somebody mentioned The Good Wife. And then we have to talk about the 27 Law and Orders. I used to love the original Law and Order. I still do. But the original Law and Order, which goes back to, you get your Jerry Orbach on the original Law and Order, Michael Moriarty.
Dennis Farina?
No.
No, what was he on?
No. He was on Dennis Farina. Yeah. Wait. No, was Dennis Farina on any of the Law and Order? Was he on Law and Order at one time? I don't remember. Maybe he was, because they went through a lot of cast members. The original Law and Order used to be on A&E, I'm not exaggerating, like 12 hours a day. That's all it was. It was like the Law and Order channel. The original, self-titled Law and Order.
Yeah, he was on Law and Order from 2004 to 2006 as Joe Fontana.
Okay.
That's where I saw him. And he was in an episode of the spinoff Trial by Jury.
Oh, Trial by Jury. I remember Trial by Jury, yeah. But Law and Order, the original Law and Order is one of the best. That's one of the best shows, because you get the reason I love Law and Order so much is like the first half is law and the second half is order. So, how about this? 708 area code says, anyone mention Jury Duty with Pauly Shore and Tia Carrera? It has a whopping 26% on Rotten Tomatoes. I can't believe it has that much. 26% is pretty high for Jury Duty. Um, 807 area code says, how about The Rural Juror starring Jenna Maloney? What is that?
It's from 30 Rock.
Oh,
The Rural Juror.
There it is. Yeah. That's right. I totally forgot about that. I should have known Jenna Maloney. But you know what popped into my head? Is that it is the actress that first popped into my head, even though now I know, you know, obviously it's Jenna from 30 Rock. The girl who's in, and I think she's great too. She was in, Neon Demon. She was also in,
Saved
and Donnie Darko. She's in Donnie Darko. What the hell's her name?
I think it is. It's Jenna Malone, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it is Jenna Malone, right? Yeah. That's what popped into my head. She popped into my head. That's why I was so confused.
It's Jenna Malone.
That's what popped into my head because I love her. I think she's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 847 area code says William Hurt made my knees weak in Body Heat in 1980. Same could be said for Kathleen Turner in that movie. So, so what are some of the other ones here? Amistad. It's another Matthew McConaughey legal movie. Because he was in The Lincoln Lawyer. He was in Time to Kill. Amistad.
Is that Spielberg?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a good one. I liked Amistad.
Oh.
I thought it was pretty good.
Oh. Let's see. Yeah, you know, have you ever seen The Lincoln Lawyer?
Yeah.
So I just think it's hilarious that he made that movie, and then like 2 years later or 3 years later, he started doing the Lincoln commercials. Because, I mean, the plot of The Lincoln Lawyer is that he's in the back of his Lincoln conducting business. That's
someone's,
the plot.
Someone saw this movie and they were like, "But that's the brand recognition we need.
Well, here's the other thing about that movie is like, you know, why would Lincoln want to? Well, first of all, they gave him the permission to use, you know, the Lincoln in the title and all that and use the Lincoln cars in the movie. So they clearly had they were okay with it. But that movie should have been called The Drinking Lawyer. Because he's drunk the whole movie. He's soused the entire movie. So I'm thinking, well, Lincoln doesn't care if their spokesman played an alcoholic in a movie that was associated with their car brand? Does that seem a little weird? We love the fact that he drinks in the back of a Lincoln.
It's The Drinking Lincoln. For 2019.
The Drinking Lawyer. That's what they should have called that movie. And it's a good movie, though. But, okay, we're going to break here for some weather, and then we're going to wrap up the whole courtroom TV and movie stuff, and we're going to pay tribute to Phil Hartman, who, by the way, would have turned 71 today. We'll talk about his life and his career. All that's coming up in a little bit. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the WGN Skyline studio here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6. 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, 2 for Tuesday. 312-981-7200. And coming up also, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right. Let's see. We're talking about courtroom movies and lawyer TV shows and movies and stuff like that. And did anyone mention The People versus Larry Flint? No, they haven't, and it's a great movie. Speaking of that, Woody Harrelson hosting the season premiere of SNL this weekend.
Mm-hmm. And next week we'll get Dolomite Is My Name.
No.
October 4th?
You mean the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because I thought you were talking about Eddie Murphy, because Eddie Murphy's hosting in December.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, Dolomite, is it next week?
Yeah, it comes out on October 4th.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a big weekend, because you got Dolomite Is My Name, which is premiering on Netflix. You got Joker, which is premiering in a toilet. And then Lucy in the Sky with Natalie Portman comes out that day, too.
Very fascinated by that one.
Yeah. Me too. But this is it goes into high gear on October 4th in terms of like, hey, high prestige, hopefully Oscar nominated movies will be coming out every single week until the beginning of 2020. And they're, you know, it's going to be a crowded field again this year. So, yeah, People versus Larry Flint's a terrific movie. It's a great movie. Milos Forman. 630 area code, Miracle on 34th Street. Boom. They just dropped the mic because they said Miracle on 34th Street?
Santa.
Now, here's one that I immediately go to. And Justice for All with Al Pacino. I love that movie. Al Pacino plays a manic and angry lawyer who must represent a judge accused of rape. The film is famous for Pacino's line, "You're out of order, you're out of order, the whole trial's out of order, they're out of order."
Not out of order.
He was nominated for an Oscar for that.
Mm-hmm.
I love that movie.
It's really great.
Yeah, Barry Levinson and Valerie Curtin wrote that. That's before Levinson started directing. That was right before he made Diner. Norman Jewison directed it. Jack Warden. Oh, man, Jack Warden. So good as the crazy suicidal judge. John Forsyth as the evil Judge Fleming. Jeffrey Tambor plays Pacino's law partner. You know, here's one. You don't immediately think of it as a courtroom movie, but Chicago. Chicago is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a musical, obviously. You know what I busted out over the weekend?
What?
All That Jazz.
Well, yeah.
Oh my god.
I actually just started rewatching Fosse Verdon today, just to go through it one more time.
I love that movie. And it always makes me think of my dad because he hates it more than anything in the world. My dad hates that movie. He can't stand it. He just could not wait for Roy Scheider to die. He was like, "When's he going to die?" First time.
Come on.
When he saw it, he's only seen it. Well, you know, I saw it twice because I showed it at my film club last year, and he came. Even though, you know, and then I was like, "Did you like it?" Afterwards, you know, because I do like a Q&A thing after my film club thing, which, by the way, we're still not sure when the theater is going to reopen. They're remodeling it. Once it remodels, we'll have the leather reclining seats in there. We'll get back to doing our film club every month. But anyway, I asked my dad afterwards. I was like, "Did you like it any better than the last time?" He's like, "No." He hates that movie. But yeah, I was, and the reason I thought of All That Jazz, obviously, is because we were talking about Chicago. But I love All That Jazz so much, and I love the last 15 minutes of All That Jazz. I love the whole movie. I think the whole movie is pretty extraordinary, a masterpiece, one of my favorite movies of all time. But the last 15 minutes of that movie with the Bye Bye Love musical number at the end with Ben Vereen and Roy Scheider I could watch it all day long. So anyway, so Chicago, that falls under that umbrella of courtroom stuff. Here's a great movie, Aaron Brockovich. Yeah, Aaron Brockovich is a great movie. I think Julia Roberts deserved that Oscar. I thought she was great. And Albert Finney, come on, man. I got all sad Sunday night during the In Memoriam when Albert Finney's face popped up on the screen. That just went, I mean, I got sad during all of it, you know, because it's sad when anybody passes away and so many talented people passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But Albert Finney, he's so good in Aaron Brockovich. Did he get nominated for that? I don't think he did. Oh, man, here's a good one. In the Name of the Father. Oh, I rarely get as angry during a movie as I did during In the Name of the Father. I was infuriated during that movie, and justifiably so. Jim Sheridan, man. Daniel Day-Lewis, Emma Thompson, Pete Postlethwaite.
Mm-hmm.
My God.
Great. I, it, it's kind of weird because it fits into a small subgenre of movies that are exclusively about the IRA.
Yeah.
Which are some people definitely have a problem with.
Yeah.
And rightfully so. But it's fascinating. And it's an incredible drama.
Oh, my God. And I mean, it goes without saying Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, obviously. But I love that movie, man. And he made a series of movies. He made some great movies with Jim Sheridan. Daniel Day. Jim Sheridan is great.
And Albert Finney was nominated for Aaron
Brockovich.
He was? Yeah.
Oh, good.
2001 Best Supporting.
Good. Who won?
I'm going to have to
Okay. Here. How about this? Legally Blonde.
But such a delightful watch. It really is.
She's really funny in that movie. I still think the best performance that Reese Witherspoon has ever given is in Election. That I think that's Reese Witherspoon. Still, to this day, I think that's her best performance. Yeah.
Benicio del Toro won for Traffic.
Oh, okay.
So you can't be mad about that.
No, I can't.
That.
I can't be mad. Can't be mad about that. Here is Mike. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Nick. Good morning.
Yeah.
Hey, what famous courtroom movie featured a famous radio station that you're on?
What courtroom movie featured a famous radio station that I'm on?
Yes.
You're going to have to remind me.
All right. It has a very young Dick York in it. Inherit the Wind.
Oh, Inherit the Wind. Oh, wait, GN is mentioned in Inherit the Wind?
Oh, it's shown in there.
Oh.
And it has a young Norman Fell setting up the microphone.
Oh, all right. All right. I didn't remember that detail. I haven't seen Inherit the Wind in probably 25 years, at least. So,
very good movie.
Yeah, it is. All right, Mike. Thanks, man.
All right. Thank you.
In fact, I believe we still have that microphone.
It's probably in the in the green room.
Yeah, the PBG Payne screen room. You can see that microphone.
Reversal of Fortune. Oh God, Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons is so good. So is Ron Silver as Alan Dershowitz, the late great Ron Silver. And then finally, The Rainmaker. I had to mention The Rainmaker because it's one of my favorite Coppola movies. And that was Mickey Rourke was so great, like a comeback performance. Danny DeVito, beautiful in that movie. Matt Damon, that is a great movie. The Rainmaker is a great movie. If you've not seen it, it's a great movie. So, okay, we're going to break because the news is up next, and then Phil Hartman would have been 71 today, so we're going to talk about Phil Hartman. We want you to jump in about your thoughts, your favorite characters, your favorite things that Phil Hartman did, and we'll do that right after we break for the news. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here on a Tuesday morning. You mean two for Tuesday? Who requested the BTO?
That's coming to us from none other than Canadian Bill.
Canadian Bill. That's right. Bachman Turner Overdrive, Canadian. There you go. All right. Welcome back, everybody. You know, I was talking in the newsroom with Vic about Phil Hartman a little bit earlier. And Vic, you were a fan of Phil Hartman's.
From the, what was the TV show? From the
radio, news radio.
From those days. That's
yeah.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. And obviously he was on Saturday Night Live.
Sure, of course.
And you know, went on, he did some movies and he would have been 71 today. But he was killed in a murder-suicide that his wife, Bryn, was responsible for. I'll never forget it. I remember hearing it. I was listening to the radio. I was at home. It was in May 28th of 1998, and I couldn't believe it. Phil Hartman's my favorite Saturday Night Live cast member of all time. He's just my favorite, and was always great in every sketch. Even if the sketch was bad, he was good. They referred to him as the glue over the years, and that's perfect because he was like, you know, the guy. If you wanted to make sure that somebody was good, you wanted to run something past them. If you were writing for someone, you always wanted to write for Phil Hartman. So it's an incredible tragedy what happened, and how it happened. And, you know, it's the story of his death is insane. This is the way it went down. And I'm just going to get this out of the way so that we can then talk about the man and how funny he was and how brilliant he was and how talented he was. May 28th, 1998. Phil Hartman was shot to death while sleeping in his Encino, California home by his wife, Bryn Hartman. Bryn left the house and later came back with a friend to show him Phil's body. When her friend went to call 911, Bryn locked herself in the bedroom with Phil's lifeless body and then shot herself. It was later discovered by the coroner that Bryn had alcohol, cocaine, and Zoloft in her system. They left behind two children, Sean Edward, who was born in 1988, which would have made him 10 when it happened, and Bergen, who was born in 1992, which would have made her 6. So you have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old in the house. You kill your husband and you kill yourself, and your kids are in the room 2 doors down. It's unbelievable. It's unimaginable. ABC did a show called The Last Days of Phil Hartman. I watched it over the weekend. They did a really good job with it. It was very, very thorough. And, you know, all the people who were involved, who were like talking heads or people that they interviewed, either worked with Phil or knew them or were related to both of them. Phil and Bryn's bodies were cremated and spread upon Catalina Island just off the coast of California on June 4th, 1998. Phil had specifically stated in his will that he wanted the ashes spread on Catalina Island because it was his favorite holiday getaway, and he was an avid boater, surfer, and a general lover of the sea. Phil was very caring and a sensitive person who was always described as very sweet and kind of quiet. That's how his life ended. Abruptly, sadly, horrifically. But what he's left behind is great. And he was one of 8 children. He was born in Brantford, Ontario, Canada, September 24th, 1948. He is of German, Irish, and English descent. The family moved to the United States when Phil was around 10. He spent the majority of his childhood in Connecticut and then in Southern California. He originally studied graphic design at California State University, and he began to work part-time as a graphic designer, designing album covers for such bands as Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Poco, and Steely Dan. He did the cover for Asia, which is one of the most iconic album covers of all time. He did several really great album covers. He was a great graphic designer and talented as hell. He got married in the early 70s to his first wife. They got divorced in 72. He remarried again in the 80s. He was married 3 times. Bryn was his final wife. In 1975, alongside doing the album work, Phil joined the California comedy troupe, The Groundlings. While in The Groundlings, Phil worked with Paul Rubens and John Lovitz, who became really good friends of him until his death. Phil and Paul created the character of Pee-wee Herman together. I don't know if people know that or not. Phil Hartman co-created Pee-wee Herman with Paul Rubens. He even had a role on Pee-wee's Playhouse. He played Captain Carl. He was in the original Groundlings production of Pee-wee's Playhouse on stage in L.A. He co-wrote the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Appears in it, too. And I don't think a lot of people know that. And he was with the Groundlings, which is a legendary, you know, comedy troupe. And then in 1976, at the age of 38, and that's pretty late in life to join SNL. Because normally when you join SNL, you're in your 20s. That's usually, you know, how old you are. Like late 20s, mid-20s, sometimes really early 30s. In the case of, though, I will say this. In the case of Leslie Jones, she was 45 when she got hired. Which is pretty cool. Phil joined the cast of Saturday Night Live then, and he was on the show for a record 8 seasons, which Kenan Thompson has doubled. That was the record, 8 seasons, and it was later broken by Tim Meadows, who held the record until Daryl Hammond broke it, who held the record until Kenan Thompson broke it. Phil played a wide range of characters, including Frank Sinatra, Bill Clinton, Ron Reagan, Ed McMahon. Yes! Ha-ha, sir! Barbara Bush and many others. He was known to help out other writers who wanted to get their sketches read and onto the show. He held Saturday Night Live together during his 8-year run, thus garnering the nickname of the show as The Glue. Phil was also known for his voice work on commercials and cartoons. He was probably most well-known for the voices of Troy McClure and Lionel Hutz. on The Simpsons. He also provided other minor voices on The Simpsons. Phil left Saturday Night Live in 1994, and in 1995, He was cast in the critically acclaimed NBC show News Radio as arrogant radio show host Bill McNeil. News Radio was a great show.
Amazing show.
Yeah, and he was great on it. So we're talking Phil Hartman. If you guys want to jump in, we would love to hear from you. Taken from us way too soon in a horrific manner. He would have been 71 years old today. So if you guys want to reminisce, we've got some audio that we're going to play from some of the really funny stuff that he has left behind. And we just want to talk about what made you laugh about Phil Hartman and what you liked about him. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Here's Steve on WGNI. Steve.
My wife and I, we still cherish the when he was Frankenstein, when they had Tonto, Frankenstein, and Tarzan.
Right.
Those were just priceless.
Yeah, the Tarzan, Frankenstein, and Tonto were hilarious. It was Kevin Nealon as Tonto.
Yeah,
Kevin Nealon was Tonto. Tarzan was it Lovitz? No. Lovitz was Tonto. Kevin Nealon was
Tarzan and Hartman.
Right, and then Frankenstein was Phil Hartman, and those were hilarious. Those were hilarious.
I want to give an honorable mention to the Chris Farley skits with Christina Applegate.
The first time that he did Matt Foley, the first time that Chris Farley did Matt Foley. In the sketch was Christina Applegate was the host. David Spade and Christina Applegate played the kids. Julia Sweeney and Phil Hartman played the parents, and Chris Farley came in as inspirational speaker Matt Foley. And it was legendary. It was one of the most legendary things ever. And as I've said before, when he goes through that table, that was not planned, or it was planned by Chris Farley, but nobody else on stage knew it. He switched out. He had the prop guys switch out a real table for a breakaway table, and did not tell anybody. Didn't tell the director. Didn't tell the cast. Didn't tell anybody. And so when he goes through that table, when you watch that sketch, Farley goes through that table. Nobody on that stage knew it was going to happen, and Spade and Christina Applegate completely lose it. But the only person who doesn't break on that stage, the only person who does not break on that stage, Phil Hartman, pro.
I don't know, Dad. I can't see so well. Is that Bill Shakespeare over there?
Well, actually, Matt, we like to encourage his writing. I wish you would just shut your yapper.
I am 35 years old.
I am thrice divorced. looks like you weren't using your paper for writing, but for doobie rolling. You're going to have a lot of time for doobie rolling when you're living in a van down by the river. And by the way, I don't know if you've ever seen, have you seen the end of the show sketch that they did, kind of the musical number that they did where it's just Phil Hartman and Chris Farley on stage at the end? And he's like consoling Chris Farley. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was Chris Farley's last episode. Or one of his last episodes or something. But if you watch that footage now, they're both dead. They both died way too young. So anyway, Phil Hartman, we're talking about the funny stuff, and we've got some funny stuff to play. But let's take a break here for some weather first, then we'll jump right back into it. Everybody hang on. 312-981-7200. We're celebrating Phil Hartman, who would have been 71 today. Talk or text us now. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Talk or text. 2 for Tuesday. 312-981-7200. We are remembering Phil Hartman. Phil Hartman would have been 71 years old today. And so we're remembering him on this on his birthday and all the great stuff that he did in movies, on television, on SNL, and all that. So here's Michael on WGN. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, Nick. Good morning. Good to be with you.
Thanks.
Two real quick ones that I wanted to mention. The first one you already covered a couple minutes ago, that he not only co-wrote Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which is one of my all-time favorite movies, but he actually had a very brief cameo at the very end, but you covered that already.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorite Phil Hartman cameos, and actually while I was on hold, I went on YouTube to see if the clip is on there, and it is. He had a very brief, maybe three-minute appearance on, I believe, the 10th episode of Third Rock from the Sun. He played a very effeminate skincare specialist.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a dialogue between him and French Stewart, who plays Harry on the show.
Right.
And it is an absolutely hysterical, like, I don't even know if it's 3 minutes long. It might even be shorter than that.
Yeah.
But it's on YouTube. All you got to do is just type in Phil Hartman, Third Rock from the Sun. It's the first thing that pops up.
Very cool.
Like I said, it's absolutely hysterical.
It is. It is. Yeah, that's great. That's a great. He's sorely missed. He was brilliant. He was brilliant.
He really, really was.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Michael.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Okay.
Third Rock from the Sun. He's the man. He also appeared in a Joe Dante TV movie called The Second Civil War. He played the president in that. Of course, he was in Jingle All the Way with Arnold.
You got to mention Small Soldiers.
Oh, my God, Small Soldiers. Boy, he just gets blown up in that movie. That's all he does is they shoot at him and blow him up in that movie.
Yeah, but he's so funny.
He's hilarious.
Because there's a bit where they blast Wannabe by the Spice Girls, and he's just, like, tortured.
Yeah.
Like, laying there with his wife.
Yeah.
He's awesome in that.
He was in the movie version of Sergeant Bilko with Steve Martin, and he was hilarious in that. He appeared on the woefully underseen and underrated Dana Carvey show. If you look at the writing staff of the Dana Carvey show, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And that show was really funny. He played Larry King on two episodes of the Dana Carvey show. Is that available? Is the Dana Carvey show anywhere?
It is absolutely available. You can get it on DVD.
It's so brilliant.
And Hulu's documentary on it is
it's so
incredible.
Brilliant. It's so brilliant.
The Diet Mug root beer.
It
Dana
just
Carvey show.
You watch that documentary and you look at the people who were involved. Look at the talent.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, it's a murderer's row of comedy writers and comedy, yeah. You know, and comedy actors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Phil Hartman did some impressions. He did a bunch on SNL, and this clip that we're going to play now. This is from 1996. This is Phil Hartman on Conan doing some impressions. Let's just listen to the great Phil Hartman doing some impressions on Conan from 1996.
Can I pick another one?
Yeah, if you want to go down one? This road.
Yeah, I like it. 81.
81 is Jim Neighbors.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
You know, like, I got a Thanksgiving gift for you, Sergeant Carter. Oh, yeah.
You know what's great?
All right.
This makes you the perfect talk show guest.
Yes.
You're fully automated. I can just sit here.
Push my buttons, baby.
Yeah, you're doing, of course, you're in town. You're doing Saturday Night Live. This week, I'm back at the old stomping grounds.
Yeah, that's great.
And I heard a rumor that you were going to reprise your Sinatra this weekend. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true, baby. I mean, get me another highball, will you? I got a pinched nerve.
I got chunks of guys like you in my stool. That was always one of my favorites. When Sting was playing Billy Idol and they were doing the Sinatra group, and the late Jan Hooks, God, she's dead too. The late Jan Hooks was Sinead O'Connor, and then Mike Myers and Victoria Jackson were Steve and Edie, and Sting, who was the host, was Billy Idol. it's one of the best. Hey, Baldy, he's screaming at Sinead O'Connor. Oh man. How about House Guest with Sinbad?
Oh, man.
Come on, man. Sinbad rules.
No, he doesn't.
Sinbad rules.
No, he does not.
Yes, he does. Sinbad is hilarious. He's hilarious. I love Sinbad.
Okay.
Whatever. And he works, and he doesn't work blue.
That's great.
Yeah.
He's incredibly successful. Not funny.
He plays, he also was the announcer on a lot of sketches on SNL. He was like the voice, he was like the sort of, cheesy sort of voiceover guy. Well, that's not the word I'm looking for. The word I'm like insincere, kind of that kind of thing. Voiceover guy that would do the voiceovers. And he, of course, did the Stuart Smalley. He would do the voiceover for the affirmation, daily affirmation. He's also in Colon Blow. One of my favorite. Oh, you have Colon Blow?
I do.
What's one of my favorite commercial parodies they ever did? But do you have some audio for Colon Blow? All right.
Your oat brand cereal would it take to equal the fiber content of one bowl of Colon Blow?
Two.
Guess again.
Three.
A little higher.
Four.
Keep trying.
Five.
No, you'll have to do better than that.
Seven.
Guess again.
Eight.
We'll give you one more guess.
Nine.
Not even close. It would take over 30,000 bowls to eat that much oat bran. You'd have to eat 10 bowls a day, every day, for 8.5 years.
Wow! I think I get the picture!
There you go. That part of that has to be visual. We have to describe that a bunch of bowls of cereal are underneath Phil Hartman's butt, and they rise up to the amount of bowls of cereal that you have to eat. And so he's like on this giant pyramid at the top of a bunch of bowls of Colon Blow.
I remember seeing that as a kid, on a rerun.
816 area code says, Nick, I love the anal retentive guy. Yeah, the anal retentive chef. You got to love the anal retentive chef. He never cooked anything. He was always like putting stuff in paper bags and Ziploc and taping them and stapling them. That was a great character. 815 area code says, I loved Phil Hartman in Greedy. He was hilarious in Greedy. It was really, really funny in that movie. 807 area code says, my favorite Phil Hartman sketches are Eugene, the anal retentive chef, and Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer. That's from Canadian Bill. After the news, we're going to play a little Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer, because that's one of my favorite characters ever. But yeah, now Phil Hartman. So damn funny, man. Okay, we're going to talk more about Phil Hartman. We want to jump in here. It's 312-981-7200. He also did voices. I don't know if you know this or not, Tom, but he did. He did voices for Ren and Stimpy.
Oh boy,
he did voice work on Ren and Stimpy. Because yeah. That's the best. Okay, we'll take a break. The news is coming up after this, and then we'll come back and have more talk and more audio from the late great Phil Hartman.
Stay at home, can't stay in school. Old folks say you're poor little fool. Stay on the streets, I'm the girl next door. I'm the fox you've been waiting for. Hello, daddy. Hello, mom. I'm your Jerry Bob.
Play it during the party at the Moon Tower. That's Dazed and Confused. All right, who requested the Runaways?
That's coming to us from Kim and Juliet.
Good choice. 2 for Tuesday wrapping up here with the Runaways. Yeah! 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here till 5. Steve Grzanich coming up at 5 with the opening bell. We are remembering the great Phil Hartman. He would have been 71 today. So we're remembering how great he was and how funny he was and playing back some of the stuff. I want to mention a few more things that he was in. Quick Change, the great Bill Murray. Have you seen Quick Change?
I have not.
Oh, no, you got to see
it. Quick Change.
Bill Murray, Gina Davis, Randy Quaid are the main stars. Jason Robards is the cop in it, the head cop in it. They're in disguise, and they rob a bank. Bill Murray co-directed it. It's got a fantastic cameo. There's got fantastic cameos throughout. Philip Bosco, who plays a very strict bus driver who wants you to stay behind that line. Phil Hartman has a small role in it. Kurtwood Smith is hilarious in one scene.
Red Foreman?
Yeah. And it is a great movie, and I wish that Bill Murray had directed more movies. It's the only movie he ever got a credit on for directing. It's really good.
That's shocking. Wow.
And it's a love letter to how terrible Manhattan is. That's what it's all about. They can't. They rob a bank, and the whole movie is about them desperately trying to get out of town. But there are like strikes and construction problems. And they can't get out of town. They rob a bank. They get away from the bank. They can't get out of town. Jason Robards is hilarious in it. It is a great movie, and Phil Hartman has a wonderful scene in it. So I seriously throw that on your never-ending list. Because that one should be pretty close. If you're moving, if you're ranking things, rank Quick Change pretty high, because it is a really, really great movie and a really funny movie. He was in Fletch Lives. Don't bother with that one. Amazon Women on the Moon, he was in. Blind Date. Now Blind Date was this Blake Edwards movie with Bruce Willis. This is early Bruce. This is like Bruce Willis from
Straight Out of Moonlight.
Moonlighting. He was still on Moonlighting. And this was like his first attempt to make a movie, big movie. Blake Edwards directed it. He goes out on a blind date with Kim Basinger. When she gets drunk, she goes nuts. That's what the movie's about. And Phil Hartman is trying to convince him. He's on the phone with him. He plays like a buddy of his. I can't remember who plays Phil Hartman's wife. But Phil Hartman calls up Bruce Willis to convince him to go out on a date with the Kim Basinger character. And He goes, when she drinks, she loses control. That's my favorite line in the entire movie. She loses control.
What the hell?
So somebody mentioned Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer, which is truly one of my favorite characters that he ever did. And one of the weirdest, I mean, I don't know who the hell came up with the idea. I think Phil Hartman came up with the idea. Because it sounds kind of offbeat and crazy enough to have come from the mind of Phil Hartman. And he is exactly that. He is an unfrozen caveman lawyer. He's got the big forehead and the hair. And so we have a little bit. I mean, they did it a bunch of times. It was a recurring character. And it was the same joke every time. But it was funny every single time. And one of the reasons why it was so funny is just the way Phil Hartman delivers the dialogue. And then the visual, you look at him, he's in a suit, but he's a caveman. And he's in the middle of all this, we were talking about great courtroom stuff. This is great courtroom stuff right here. So let's hear a little bit of Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer with Phil Hartman.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman. I fell in some ice and later got thawed out by some of your scientists. Your world frightens and confuses me. Sometimes the honking horns of your traffic make me want to get out of my BMW and run off into the hills or whatever. Sometimes when I get a message on my fax machine, I wonder, did little demons get inside and type it? I don't know. My primitive mind can't grasp these concepts. But there is one thing I do know. When a man, like my client, slips and falls on a sidewalk in front of a public library, then he is entitled to no less than $2 million in compensatory damages and $2 million in punitive damages.
So brilliant. So brilliant. So ridiculously funny. I'm going to get out of my BMW and run into the hills or whatever. Oh, man. If you guys want to jump in, we're talking about Phil Hartman. Would have been 71 today. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 219 area code says, Nick, my favorite Phil Hartman skit is the debate that played on the eve of the 92 election. Hartman played Clinton. Dana Carvey played both Bush and Perot. Those are, the election years are always pretty strong on SNL, and his Clinton was fantastic.
Very good Clinton.
But why don't we hear his Clinton? This is one of the most famous times that he played Bill Clinton in a sketch where he's talking to, he's being a regular guy and he's going, he was going for a run and he decided to stop off in a local McDonald's. And this is Phil Hartman doing Bill Clinton in a McDonald's.
Besides, Mrs. Clinton asked us not to let you into any more fast food places.
Well, I just want to mingle with the American people, talk with some real folks, maybe get a Diet Coke or something.
All right, fine. But please, don't tell Mrs. Clinton.
Jim, let me tell you something.
There's going to be a whole bunch of things we don't tell Mrs. Clinton. Fast food is the least of our worries, okay, buddy?
Oh, my God, it's Bill Clinton.
Oh, my God. Hey, oh, that's an adorable baby. What's your name, sweetheart?
Her name is Shakira.
Shakira, that means African princess, doesn't it?
Oh, why, yes!
Well, she certainly is beautiful enough to be a princess. Say, you gonna finish these fries?
Is that Alan Cleghorn?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, man.
There's gonna be a whole bunch of stuff we don't tell Mrs. Clinton.
The Diet Coke thing, I say that to people a lot.
Yeah, you get a Diet Coke or something.
Yeah, so what are you going to do today? I'm going to go see my mom, maybe stop by a church, go get a Diet Coke or something.
Yeah, God, he was funny. He was so funny. 608 area code says, the best thing about Phil Hartman was that he was a genius on both sides of a sketch. He could either be very comic or can be the straight man, equally great. Absolutely true. He could do the characters, you know, yeah, but he was like we said when we were talking about him, he was the glue. He was the glue on SNL. Even if he had two lines in a sketch, he delivered and he stayed in character and he was, you know.
And it's a very rare quality in a performer that you can be both the straight man and the crazy guy.
The thing about it, when you think of Phil Hartman, you don't necessarily think, because, you know, a lot of the stars that everybody talks about, that kind of breakout, they all have catchphrases. Like, everybody had these recurring characters that had these catchphrases. I don't know of a single catch, besides, like some of the lines that we were just talking about. But when you think Phil Hartman, you don't think, oh, he's got a whole bunch of t-shirts that have catchphrases. No, that wasn't the kind of guy he was on SNL. He didn't try to land a character so that he could say the same catchphrase over and over again every week.
He's about as well-rounded as they come.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was great. He was just great in everything that he did. He was also, when Madonna's Sex Book came out, as it's the second time this has been mentioned on the show this morning, because when somebody called up with a body of evidence, that came out around the same time as Madonna's Sex Book, they did a sketch where they were reading passages. They were reading passages from Madonna's Sex Book. Celebrities were coming in for the audiobook recording of Madonna's sketchbook or Sex Book. And if I'm not mistaken, he did Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston reading from Madonna's Sex Book, and it was about one of the funniest things I've ever heard. And his Charlton Heston was fantastic. He used to do a fantastic Charlton Heston as well. Every time he would do Charlton Heston, it would, like, he'd get shot in the arm. He'd go, damn! Like, that was always, because Charlton Heston used to get shot in the shoulder a lot in movies, and then just grab his shoulder and go, damn! And that, by the way, I don't know if you're looking for the Charlton Heston Sex Book thing. I don't think it's appropriate to play this morning. So that's all I'm saying. But it's hilarious. You got to take my word for it. Go on YouTube and find it. I'm not going to take any chances. Although it did appear on regular television, but it was late night television. I don't want to take any chances.
No, this is a family show.
Yeah. Well, it's not really, but I don't want to play it, going on 5 o'clock. Everybody's waking up and they don't want to hear Charlton Heston. But it is Charlton Heston he played, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Charlton Heston reading from Madonna's Sex Book. All right, we're going to break here for the weather, and when we come back, we got to talk about his contributions to The Simpsons. So great. Just such great stuff. So we'll do that. We'll take a break, and we'll come back and talk about some of the stuff that he did in The Simpsons. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How's it going? It's Tuesday morning, wrapping up 2 for 2. So, yeah, man, 2 for 2. And we're in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, as we are every weekday morning, 1 to 5. Coming up, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, talking about and celebrating the work of the great Phil Hartman. He was taken from us too soon in a horrible way back in 1998. He would have been 71 today on his birthday. So we're just remembering how funny he was. We talked about a bunch of the great stuff that he did on SNL. We talked about News Radio and some of the movies that he's been in and how funny he was in those. But he also contributed some really memorable and hilarious stuff to The Simpsons. We mentioned Lionel Hutz, who's another lawyer. Not a caveman, but a lawyer. But of course, now this your Tom, your favorite.
Yeah,
is Troy McClure.
God, Troy McClure is so funny.
Yeah. I love that it's a combination of Troy Donahue and Doug McClure. Troy McClure, that's how they came up with the name. You know, he did other voices for The Simpsons as well. He contributed other voices to The Simpsons as well, but he's mostly remembered, well, we mentioned Lionel Hutz, but also Troy McClure is one of the most beloved Simpsons characters ever. And we have a little bit of audio. If you remember the episode where they did the Planet of the Apes musical, speaking of Charlton Heston, where they did the Planet of the Apes musical, we have a little audio from that.
I hate every ape I see, from chimpanzee to chimpanzee. No, you'll never make a monkey out of me. Oh my God, I was wrong. It was Earth all along. You finally made a monkey.
Yes, we finally made a monkey.
Yes, you finally made a monkey out of me. I love you, Dr. Zayas.
Classic. Absolute classic.
I mean, it combines two of my favorite things, Troy McClure and Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. Chimpanzee to chimpanzee. I mean, what are you going to, what can you say about that?
And they do the Amadeus parody, Dr. Zayas.
Yeah, Dr. Zayas, Dr. Zayas, Dr. Zayas, Dr. Zayas, Dr. Zayas.
Oh, Dr. Zayas. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
He's also the monorail salesman. That's Phil Hartman, which is, you know, not a recurring character, but nonetheless one of the most memorable episodes of The Simpsons, and he's hilarious on it. Smarmy, that was the word I was trying to think
smarmy.
Of.
Smarmy.
That was the word earlier I was trying to think of. He was always the smarmy voiceover guy, you know, or the smarmy announcer.
He's just got that quality to his voice.
Yeah. Okay, so this one is one of your favorites, correct? The next bit we're going to play? All right. Explain what it is.
So this is, he does a nature documentary called Man Versus Nature, The Road to Victory.
Right.
And I just like it whenever he does, that's a recurring thing with Troy, is that he's always doing these videos.
Right. And PSAs and industrials. Like the one about the one where they go through the slaughterhouse and the kid is completely. And every single time, it's funny, every single time when Troy McClure introduces himself and says, you might remember me from some movie, such movies, and all those titles of everything, or such industrial films or PSAs as.
Yeah, something.
Smoke Yourself Thin was one of them.
Yeah, Smoke.
Smoke Yourself Thin. Oh, man. All right, well, here, this is the Nature Man Versus Nature Road to Victory.
Hi, I'm Troy McClure. You may remember me from such nature films as Earwigs, Ooh! And Man Versus Nature, The Road to Victory. In all the animal kingdom, no mother is more devoted than the blue jay. Valuing her eggs above even her own life, the mother bird bravely fights off such fearsome predators as the badger and the mongoose. Of course, one thing Mother Blue Jay can't defend against is a set of steel tongs. Eggs, precious eggs. If they're to survive, they require the gentle warmth and tender love that only a mother can provide. Or better yet, a 75-watt bulb. Oh, hello. In a few days, our eggs will hatch into nestlings like these over here.
They look awfully hungry, Mr. McClure.
They sure are, Billy. In nature, their mother would regurgitate food for them to eat.
That's gross.
It sure is, Billy. It sure is.
Steel tongue.
Oh, man. Also, I just had it in my head, and now I completely forgot it. That he was in, Troy McClure was in, oh man, now I completely blanked because I laughed at that last line. I completely forgot about it because I laughed so hard at that last line. But yeah, all the Troy McClure stuff is legendary. Oh, I know what it was. When they did the anniversary special, it was like, I don't know what it was, like maybe the 200th episode or something like that. And they did like Troy McClure was the host. And he was like, and they showed a clip from like early Simpsons when they looked completely different in the
like
animation.
Tracy Ullman stuff, yeah.
Yeah, the Tracy Ullman stuff. And the animation was, you know, the voices sounded different. The animation was not as good. And they didn't have that iconic look that the characters had. They show the clip, they cut back to Troy McClure, and he's looking at the camera, and he goes, "They haven't changed a bit."
Just some of the names of the movies
Troy McClure was in? All right.
Yeah, Hitler Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Christmas Ape and Christmas Ape Goes to Summer Camp. Today We Kill, Tomorrow We Die.
Oh, yeah. That was one of my favorites, yeah.
Oh, God. The Revenge of Abe Lincoln. The President's Neck is Missing. The Muppets Go Medieval.
There you go. Those are just some of the credits of Troy McClure.
Ridiculous.
Oh, man. Okay, so we were talking a little bit earlier about this sketch that Phil Hartman and Chris Farley did together, where Phil Hartman was comforting Chris Farley. And it's really, obviously, really incredibly melancholy to watch now because they're both gone. Both Chris Farley and Phil Hartman are both gone. And this was just the end of it, one of the end of the shows. I think it was one of Farley's last shows.
Yeah, I think it was definitely Phil Hartman's final episode.
Oh, then it was Phil Hartman's last show.
Because
Phil Hartman, Phil Hartman left. Yeah, no, he had. Yeah, I think he left before Farley. I think he left. No. Farley died, I think, just a few months after Phil Hartman left. Because it was like 97, maybe, when Farley died?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, 4 years from this point, from this sketch, they were both dead.
Yeah, they were both. They both passed
within
away.
4 years of that.
Okay, well, Farley passed away first, and then Hartman was killed in 98. But, all right, so this is it. This is like, if you ever see this on YouTube, it's really, really melancholy to watch now, but they were two of the greats from Saturday Night Live, and this was their last time on stage together.
Chop liver, I need to sleep in a van down by the river.
You know, I can't imagine a more dignified way to end my 8 years on this program. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Just so sad. They're both gone. Taken from us way too soon. So, Phil Hartman would have been 71 today. So I suggest maybe bust out some Saturday Night Live or some news radio. Watch some news radio today because he was hilarious on that show. And get a house guest with Sinbad.
You cannot make me watch a Sinbad movie. You cannot.
What is it? What do you don't like about Sinbad?
I just don't think he's funny.
He's funny, man. So, anyway. All right, Phil Hartman. Happy birthday to Phil Hartman. And thank you for all of the incredible laughs and memories. Okay, we'll be back tomorrow, Wednesday. Who do we got on the show tomorrow?
Tomorrow we're going to be welcoming Robert Rodriguez.
Yes.
Not the director.
No, not the director, but the Beatles expert and writer of many books. It's the 50th anniversary of Abbey Road. Mm-hmm. So we will celebrate that with Robert tomorrow. And Wildcard Wednesday and Know Your Onion as well.